Hello and welcome to episode number 41 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane.
It's a pleasure to see you, Rob.
Is it? Why?
I don't know.
This sounds like a...
I was just trying to be polite.
Terrible.
That was the most formal opening ever had, all guys. Right. I was a little bored.
It's not a pleasure. We're about to get heated.
Oh, it is. We are getting heated political.
Also with us is Rebecca McKendry.
Hello, guys.
Hi, how are you?
It's a pleasure to see you both.
Oh,
you too, Becca.
You too, Elric.
Fans were in uproar about our little tit-a-tat on Twitter. I had friends writing to me going, is this a real fight? Is this the end of Shockwave?
Somebody wrote to me and they were like, why do you let them talk to you like that? And I was like, oh, dear God. So Elric and I are tweeting each other the whole time.
All about mansplaining.
All about Fandor, really.
Fandor.
I believe we were called dickheads.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Because you know, Becca put it out there, and it wasn't put into any context whatsoever.
Thanks, Becca.
I read one comment that said, what a bunch of dickheads.
Actually, I didn't put it out there. Several people started tweeting memes and various things.
Well, they're wrong.
To defend them, they're right.
Are they?
We're a bunch of dickheads. Come on, buddy. All right,
okay, the best possible way. Elric.
No, Elric, you were.
No. Elric.
No, but I said check the tapes.
Not as big a dickhead as Elric is Ryan Turek, also with us.
Thanks. We'll get through the opening first.
Hello.
It is great
to see all three of you today.
Let me explain something to you, Ryan.
Oh, was there more
than
that?
Can men mansplain to each other?
Let's all drop this, especially since we now have two females in the house.
That's right. Evening it out, and she's going to be our co-host today. One of the things that we decided to do is, I guess once a month we're going to try to tackle a topic.
Yeah.
And just riff on it, and we thought it'd be fun to bring in friends for these topic episodes.
Interview-less episode.
Yes, yeah. Because this person has been on our previous show, Killer POV.
A couple of times. No.
Once.
We had you on for Mystic Party.
Yeah.
There
was
you
a
go.
Crossover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so it was technically a crossover. Not
the
a
suspense.
Straight show.
Sure. I'm talking about Bria Grant.
Yay! It's nice to see all of you dickheads.
Yay!
One of us. One of us, brat.
I just want to say to all of the listeners out there, if you do follow us on social media, get informed about how our vibe is, because we pick on each other quite a bit.
If they've been listening to Killer POV, they must know on our side at least.
Yeah, nothing is ever personal. We're just like having fun.
Oh, no, I take it personal.
I'm the most
serious of the bunch.
Elric and I are like super close off the show. So when people are like, oh my God, is this it? We're like, let's play it up even more.
I think Mike Mendez asked me that. I think I ran into him and goes, oh, is this the Yoko
Mike,
moment? And I was like,
Jesus,
come on, Mike.
Come on.
What the hell, Mike?
Oh my God.
Jesus.
I follow all of you, but I have no idea what you're talking about. But it's
probably for the best.
The recap is unnecessary.
Great. All right.
So Bria has done a lot of horror films. Big horror fan as well. Most recently, Beyond the Gates.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which Jackson Stewart directed. I just read today that comes out. It's on VOD now, but it's coming out May 2nd on DVD Blu-ray.
Excellent.
From Scream Factory.
That's great. I didn't know that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Your movie's coming out soon.
She's always just plugging her shit. I can't stand it. Look at her.
People don't keep us informed as actors. Like, we're just kind of people. You just read it and you're like, oh, I guess that is when it's coming out. That's fantastic.
Right. That's great. Mm-hmm. And then what else do you kind of have that's about to come out or out now?
I have another movie coming out in theaters called Dead Awake, and I don't know when that is. I also want to say that's in May, but I couldn't actually tell you.
Oh, the one with Jocelyn Donahue.
Jocelyn Donahue is the lead.
That's
and
cool.
Jesse Bradford and Lori Petty. And it has a good cast.
Jeffrey Reddick wrote it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Any good?
Cool. All right.
Did you say, is it any good?
Now you're in the hot seat.
The best movie you've seen in your entire life.
Okay, cool. Nice.
Wow. That's high praise.
I'm just kidding.
Actual quote for the box.
Is that a quote from Bria Grant?
From Shockwave.
One of the actors.
No, say Shockwaves.
Shockwaves.
Parentheticals. I'm in this movie.
I'm in this movie.
That's why she came to host our show, so she could give her own quote for the box. Nicely done. Well played. Like it.
That's cool. And then Apple Cart would just come in later.
Who knows?
This year, I hope.
That's a movie, too.
All right, great.
Yeah, that's another movie that I'm also in. I don't know. It hasn't even gone to festivals yet, so who, you know.
Okay, did I screw that one up?
Listen.
Did I talk about that too soon?
No. I'm happy about that one. I want
people
to see it. We're in post.
I've been talking to...
I know. Yeah.
Well,
I
next
know,
week too. We'll get to talk to the producer of that movie, so there, it's relevant.
Oh, Don? Oh. Don is coming in?
Yes.
I'm not supposed to say that.
No.
Was that a secret?
We just don't want to jinx it.
Oh.
We're off to a swimmingly great start.
Great. I know, right? Great episode.
Can we start over? Is that what you
mean? Yeah.
First 5 minutes.
So to actually start off, I would love to reflect on an actor's passing.
We have to.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bill Paxton passed over the weekend due to complications with a surgery or something like to that degree. There's not. I don't know if they've completely fully divulged what's going on.
But in his, WTF, he took that's having rheumatic fever as a
problem.
Kid, and that
right.
it did cause complications for him later,
right,
which is really sad. But that's also the reason he became an actor. So had he not had the rheumatic fever, he would have been a jock and never done sport, never acted. So it's you know kind of an interesting trade.
Yeah. But what a shock, man! Yeah. That's one I definitely
absolutely.
Didn't see coming.
No,
well, he was only 61 or something. Yeah?
61 years old. Yeah, I mean, like my dad. I mean, like your dad. They've all lived past that, and for him, I mean, it's so young. He was one of the first actors that I think. As a kid, I latched onto. Like, I recognized that's a good actor. He's doing something I love. I'm going to imitate him until my parents say, please stop quoting movies from quoting lines from Aliens.
Yeah, he was always the live wire. Like, I loved that element of him. It's like, oh, Bill Paxton, and there's something crazy is going to happen.
Yeah. Also, for actors, I think he's really great because he's both a character actor but also does leads, you know? Mm. And so you see him do these, like, crazy, like, he does Aliens, which he's much more like a character guy.
Right.
But then you get to see him lead a movie, which is so interesting.
Well, Frailty.
Yeah, Frailty's great. That's actually one of the ones I watched that I wanted to talk about in a bit.
I posted this up on my Twitter, but it's still like one fact that I'm like, wow, Bill Paxton directed the Barnes & Barnes video Fish Heads.
Yeah.
That, and he's in it.
Yeah,
and
it was musical, right?
My mind.
Didn't he have an album of some kind? I think he recorded
Because I posted a video today two days ago as of this airing on the Shockwaves group. It's like a 20-minute interview he did pretty recently.
A little retrospective.
And they start talking right at the beginning about this little fish head short that he made.
Which got him connected to James Cameron
because they were working on Galaxy of Terror. My favorite story about those two, though, it's told in the Evil Dead 2 commentary, but Bill Paxton has told it and so has Cameron, is that when Evil Dead 2 came out, Cameron literally called him and he's like, dude, what are you doing? He's like, nothing. He's like, good, I'm picking you up in 15 minutes. We're going to go see Evil Dead 2. And so I just love the idea of Cameron pulling up in his car and picking up Paxton and going straight to see Evil Dead 2 together.
Cool. Yeah, he, Paxton, I didn't realize this until, you know, I was kind of doing my, you know, brush up on Bill Paxton beyond his acting career. And he did a lot of set tech stuff, you know, a lot of production design stuff. Yeah, and it was... I forgot the other films he was involved with, but, you know, as the Yahoo video talked about, it was, you know, about – it was Cameron working on Galaxy of Terror, and he needed an extra hand, and he just called up Bill Paxton and was like, hey, come on board. And then from there, the relationship began. And didn't – in that video, didn't he also say that he introduced Cameron to Michael Biehn?
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And it's somebody else from that ended up being in The Terminator.
Yeah.
And acting wasn't the thing. In that WTF episode, he basically says – the thing he came out here to do was to direct. It was always about trying to make movies. He was never about acting, and somehow that became this career for him. And now, in the last interview, he said he didn't think he would act again. That interview, he said, I think I'm not going to act again. I'm just going to focus the rest of my career on trying to get
films made.
Well,
he was supposed to do, I thought it was a Joe Lansdale story.
Yeah,
he talked about that. Was going to be his next movie.
He worked on it for years and said he couldn't get it up.
What was interesting, I lost my train of thought, but no, he's fantastic. I mean, after Aliens, then I went back and watched Weird Science.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he's so good
in it. I didn't. Oh, Edge of Tomorrow. Back on track. Edge of Tomorrow. When that movie came out, I had not read anything about it. So when he popped up, I was like, oh my god, yes, of course. Who else would play this guy but Bill Paxton?
Yeah,
it was such a great surprise.
That is a great movie to go in knowing nothing. I knew
nothing. Yeah, I knew nothing about it either.
Yeah. I still haven't watched it. So I
was
still nothing. except that Bill Paxton's in it.
Now you know that.
You've got to see it. It's
I read
really
the book,
good.
Actually. Yeah. It's based on a book called All You Need Is Kill,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you should
take
go
it back
see.
And just bring it, read some manga.
It's not a manga book. It's like a straight up novel.
Oh, really?
I read the, well, you know what? I think there's a novelization of the manga. And I read the novelization. But anyway.
It's pretty terrific. Yeah.
The ending's different, though, in the book.
Oh, is it? Okay. I have it in 3D, so if you wanted to see it. On top of Dracula 3D, which.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we got it. We got to hit that. No, I mean, I think it's rare now with the kind of, a lot of the actors working now, I think, are when you have these casting agents often trying to force people into projects from TV, what you're losing out on is these people who are completely themselves on screen and then make the character kind of work within their persona. Mm-hmm. And Bill Paxton was so fresh in that way. Like, that is him. Like, this is Bill Paxton. He's taking all the stuff he's already got and ready to go and then just giving that little twist to the character. And it makes it so much more authentic. Yeah. And I think of, like, you know, actors from the 70s that seemed to be very common then. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like it's less and less, and it makes things... It's just not as alive. And that's the irony. He's so alive.
Well, speaking to that point, as a kid, you know, growing up and seeing Terminator and then Aliens and then watching Predator 2, and then when the new James Cameron joint hits the screen, you're kind of like, where's Bill Paxton? Yeah. What role have they thrown him into? And then he pops up.
Was he in Avatar at all? I don't recall him in Avatar.
No, but he was in True Lies.
True Lies is a
great role.
But, you know, it was one of those things. Is like, what are they going to throw Bill Paxton into next? And I remember, too, I haven't seen it in ages, but The Vagrant.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember just like reading Fangoria and seeing all these wild publicity stills of Bill Paxton from The Vagrant, like holding a head. And then obviously the VHS cover is like him screaming with this crazy homeless man in the background.
I think it's on Amazon Prime right now because I was going to watch it before the show and I found it, but then didn't have time.
Let's watch it. We should watch it for the next one.
I still think that Chet from Weird Science is the greatest 80s brother villain.
Oh, he's amazing.
All time. And one of my favorite things in that video that I shared, like I couldn't not laugh when he got to talking about that because he's very serious about everything. And he just said like he went in and met with John Hughes and like he came up with the idea that he'd be in the military, which is so perfect for. And he's like, my dad used to say things like a greasy pork sandwich. So he's like improvising things that his dad would say to him and stuff.
And he did have a beautiful story in that interview on WTF where he's talking about how he got to work with his dad the last like 20 years. And his dad only died like a couple years ago. His dad was like 91.
Yeah.
And he was acting in all of Bill's movies with him. And he was like, this is the best life ever. He's like, I'm getting to hang out with my dad and do all this stuff. So it feels like he lived like 10 more lives than most of us get to live. But in the same token, it's way too short.
He left us a really long legacy as well as a incredibly talented actor son, James Paxton. We are actually doing something with James, and the kid is just – he knocks it out of the park. He's so awesome. And he's got his dad's charm too, you know.
Would I recognize him already?
He's on a TV show called Eyewitness.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think of the other thing that it was the first thing I had seen him in before we came on board this other project. But he's great.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, Elric, why don't we start with Frailty since we watched that?
And I hadn't seen it since it first came out. And I remember my memories were very vague, except that it was very serious. That's what I remembered being surprised by the tone of that film. I really liked it. I mean, a lot of people love it. You know what's funny? And this isn't meant to be a slight in any way. It is almost exactly the pilot of Supernatural, the show, without humor and without visual effects.
Yes.
it's the exact story.
It is.
It's like the serious version of that pilot.
It's a grounded version of Supernatural.
It's really the same story. But, but done, you know, definitely more like a Tales from the Crypt or something like that. But I really liked it. And I kind of know where the story's headed, but because of the performances are at such a high caliber and the mood of the piece is so kind of straight, I really enjoyed it. I had fun. You know, it didn't feel like something I'd already seen before when I watched it.
Yeah, I mean, the first time you see – I mean, again, I hadn't seen it since it came out, but like the first time you see it is such a different experience from the second time because you're following the story along from the perspective of the little boy, and it's like, is his dad crazy?
Almost like a noir, like gothic noir.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very – yeah, but it's got that Hitchcock flavor to it. I will say it has, in my opinion, because, you know, as we get older, there's not much that scares us anymore in movies, but it's like The Exorcist 3 has that one scare that gets you every time. To me, Don't Look Now has one of those scares. Mm-hmm. Frailty has a scare that gets me every time.
Which
and
part?
It's kind of, I don't want to give it away, but it's kind of in the middle where it involves an axe wielding kid. And every time that moment comes, it's just the way that it's cut together, the scream, the way it's, you know, put together, it's just every time I'm like, oh shit. And it gets me so. I love that movie.
There's some Powers Booth in that. And I'll watch anything with Powers Booth anytime, any day. Playing kind of like, you know, the straight cop for most of the film, so it's kind of surprising. But it's interesting to watch, and it's interesting to see that it's always curious, like, what is the movie you make? You're an actor your whole career, and that's the movie that at that point of his career, he's like, I'm going to direct this movie. And you're like, oh, that's an interesting choice. It's against type, and he's got a good role for himself. I love it when he plays straight like that in A Simple Plan. I love him when he plays like a straight leading man versus the Bill Paxton kind of humor. Mm. Good film. People should definitely a good one for them to check out this week.
Yeah, and I think it's only like $5. The Blu-ray's only like $5 on Amazon right now.
Because it's streaming on something. Vudu, maybe?
Oh, maybe, yeah. But yeah, it's pretty accessible.
Yeah.
So nice. Becca, what'd you see this week?
I'll start with Dead Time Stories.
Ooh. Oh yeah.
Which Rob did the bonus features for. Wow. So he can tell us about it as well. This one is coming out very soon from Scream Factory, right?
It is officially
excellent. So this one is from 1986, and for me, it was one of those that I'd always seen the box cover and that I swore I had seen before. I was like, of course I've seen this box cover. I've seen this box cover many, many times. And as soon as I started watching it, I was like, I've never fucking seen this. So I started watching it. One of the greatest opening songs ever. It's still in my head. It's so freaking catchy. And apparently the director wrote all of the songs. There's like little songs in between each of the segments.
Oh, those days when directors would write their own music.
It's like totally a Horsham Gordon Lewis move. Like, I want an opening song. I'm writing it. And so, yeah, but it's a really catchy little tune. It's a very kind of classic 80s anthology where it's a wraparound in three stories. And the setup is that this horrible uncle is being forced to babysit his nephew, or is it a dad? I'm going to go with uncle.
I think uncle.
I'm going to say uncle. Is being forced to babysit his nephew, and the nephew won't go to bed and wants some stories. And so the uncle starts telling him these like incredibly risque adult stories with like nudity and boobs and sex and a lot of death.
All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. Stories. Yeah. Dead Time Stories. Mm-hmm. What I discovered once I started like researching it is it's actually produced by this guy named Steve Mackler, who I know. So I now have to. He did a lot of work with Fangoria. He also produced Neon Maniacs.
Oh, wow.
Steve Mackler. And it's three fairy tales. So that's the setup, is that this uncle is telling these fairy tales to his nephew, but they're like twisted versions. The first one, it's a witch. It's kind of a loose Hansel and Gretel. The cool thing is it has Nick from Family Ties in it.
Scott Valentine.
Scott Valentine.
Oh, also demon lover.
My demon lover. So the whole time you're watching it and you're like, A. The whole time.
A. I love that guy so much.
Every time he comes on screen, A. And then the second one is Little Red Riding Hood, which was actually my favorite of all of them. And then the third one is just fucking nuts. It's a version of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But Goldilocks breaks into people's houses because she's actually a serial killer.
Yeah.
And then she breaks into the bear's house, but then the bears are like completely screwed up too. So she decides to hang around with them while they commit crimes.
But are they real bear? Are they people?
No, they're actors.
They're actors.
And I have seen this. I wasn't sure until the Goldilocks. I have a memory of the Goldilocks thing.
That one is so campy and so over the top and so like it's Leave It to Beaver, like My Three Sons-esque humor. In this modern day take, and it's got like these weird sex scenes, and it's just strange. So that one by far was the most bizarre. Really campy, but at the same time, I had fun with it. Like, even though that I'm like, that wasn't very well done. There was never a part I was not amused.
So you're leaning more towards the positive end of the spectrum in terms of anthology.
Because even though it was not the cleanest, most well done anthology ever, and the stories by no means were cohesive.
Right.
There was never a time when I wasn't amused.
Is it 90s? Yeah, there's
something
or
cool. There's something cool.
It's 86.
Early 80s. Yeah. It took them a couple of years to make it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was fun because I got asked very last minute to do the special features, and usually you interview people separately, but that was all back-to-back, so it was all of them coming to the same studio, seeing each other for the first time in years. So it was like Scott Valentine, and I like freaked out. I was like, as I was interviewing him, I'm like, this guy needs to play like David Naughton's brother in something, because they both look identical now later in life. And Melissa Leo, who is
Frozen River and all that.
Yeah, yeah, really? It's her first movie. Mm-hmm. Because they all came up in New York together as part of like the New York theater scene.
Right.
Yeah.
So they all knew each other back then and did it. And I had never heard of this movie up until the very early days of Icons of Fright. Jeff Hayes, who ran the Sleepaway Camp website, did an interview with Goldilocks, Catherine DePrune. And he's like, oh, can you run this on Icons? I was like, I've never even heard of this movie. But it's kind of like a long-lost gem from from kind of that early era of the 80s when stuff would play on 42nd Street. Yeah. Like, what kind of weird thing is this?
It's bizarre because it's definitely a very adult film. Like, there's several nude scenes, there's sex scenes throughout. But at the same time, it's got this very kind of campy kid vibe to it. So you feel uncomfortable while watching.
That sounds
but
good.
But it's kind of amusing at the same time.
Question mark.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And again, the director wrote songs. So there's an opening song, and then each one of the segments has another little song.
Oh, yes.
Like, you're
which,
just like, oh, we get a
song. Which company is going to put this soundtrack
already
out?
Already out.
Does he perform them as well?
Is it? Yeah.
I don't know if he performs them.
Oh, gosh.
I know that there's four songs throughout the... And
can we do a live show? Blumhouse presents.
Sure.
The songs from Dead Ten Stories.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll make it happen. First.
Let's do it, guys.
Cool,
I'm
your
all
jet.
In.
Is there a perfect anthology? Like, have we ever discussed, like, whether one of them where there's no weak spots, where there's a film you don't kind of like.
That's tough.
I think, I don't know.
Creepshow.
There's always a weak one. What?
Creepshow.
Perfect, though?
I would say Tales of Halloween, or Trick or Treat gets close.
Yeah,
Trick or Treat is,
but that doesn't feel like an anthology, weirdly, the way it's structured.
It is,
I know it is. You're right, but it feels so,
if I had
so
to pick one,
it'd
be that, although I do have a soft spot for Tales from the Dark Side, the movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I know, but there's always that one story. I'm just, Creepshow,
what's the weakness of Creepshow? That's too stuffed?
I think that is just too many. It's not actually – some people don't like Jordy, though.
My only thing is the repetitiveness of it. I mean, it's like, they're coming back from the dead to seek revenge. Oh, but right. I mean, overall
that's a
lot
I agree
of
fun. It's the best.
Yeah.
And maybe the one with the dummy, the British one, Dead of Night.
There's
no
weak
spot in that. That's just kind of classic.
Yeah, but that's got like some definite – like they're not – even though that I think they're all good in Dead of Night, they're not all on the same par.
There's a good mirror one.
This one's okay. This one's okay. That one's really good. Holy fuck, Walking Puppet. And so it's like that one is just so miles above the rest.
But even seeing XX was interesting because my feeling watching that movie was, oh, I like every one of these shorts, but am I satisfied as a whole film? I wasn't really.
Right.
And so it's a weird feeling with – and then I think that goes – same with Southbound. It's like, oh, wow, this one moment, like Bruckner's, holy shit.
Yeah, the
and then the next thing happens and you're
amazing.
Like, oh, okay.
Well, maybe it's not about
a hard format.
Maybe it's not about perfection. It's more about satisfaction.
Yeah. Satisfaction. Yeah.
What's the most satisfactory?
Yeah.
Was it amusing to watch?
And I think also coherence, right? As long as they all kind of like fit together in a way. Mm-hmm. Like
that's
thematic.
What I was hoping from XX. I wanted something thematically, I mean, after having a conversation with the filmmakers, I understood a little bit more in terms of how it could thematically all come together, but I was hoping for something maybe a little bit...
it wasn't planned. They didn't plan it in
advance.
Right,
exactly.
So no
I was hoping
together.
For something a little bit more planned.
Yeah it didn't feel like they were like going for one specific theme, for sure.
No, which is a choice. But anyway, we'll do anthologies again at some point. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Brian?
Can of worms, Zoe.
Yeah, I know.
This weekend I rented The Girl with All the Gifts,
which is
fantastic.
I almost did it last night.
Fantastic movie.
It's so good.
It came out overseas last year. Finally, we have finally caught up to it here. It is now in limited theatrical release as well as VOD. Mm-hmm.
But on the iTunes, I think. So if you don't do iTunes,
I think
that's the only
one.
Are you
sure?
I suppose
I
got limited theatrical, actually.
I mean, it's not. It's definitely not a wide release movie. I don't think that.
It feels like it should be to me. I mean, when I saw it, I was like, I feel like people will love this
movie.
Well,
it has the scope. It's got the concept, but it doesn't have the name value that's going to draw people in.
Isn't Glenn Close in it?
Yeah,
Glenn Close is in it, but you're not
going like,
to. But you're not going to slap, you know,
Glenn Close
on a zombie movie, you know, on a poster for a zombie movie. But and the funny thing is now having played The Last of Us, the video game, now I understand what all the backlash was because this film certainly seems heavily influenced by The Last of Us, which has this kind of like fungal and virus thing that takes people over and then turns them into zombies kind of thing. I've only played the first half of Last of Us. But
how does it set itself apart from the world of Walking Dead and everything we've been inundated?
In the sense that our main character, Melanie, who is played by this very talented little girl named, I'm going to butcher her name, Sanaya Nanua. She had only done a short film before this, and this is her feature debut. She is like half zombie. So basically, in the world of this, you know, you are basically taken over by one of those like funguses that infect your brain, and then it takes over your body, and you become a carnivorous creature. And here, she plays this young girl who was born within someone who was infected. And she is part of a batch of children who were born at the time of infection. So they have a little bit of that going on, but it doesn't take her over fully. But every once in a while, she'll pick up on your pheromones and then she gets really hungry and she needs to eat. But basically, she heralds a new kind of humanity, a kind of a new human race. And the lone survivors, Glenn Close, Gemma Arterton, and a handful of other actors, they're kind of like, it's the typical Romero situation where they're like the last people on Earth. They're like, they're scientists. They're trying to figure this out. They're military. And Glenn Close thinks she's got a cure for this. But the movie is kind of about, all about normalizing in a terrifying situation. And it's like,
don't tell we too can much push. More.
No.
I'm right there with you now. Yeah. I'm ready to rent it.
But it's really well done. The director, Cole McCarthy, he did another British movie called Outcast, which was kind of like a creature feature in the UK. And this is just a really assured direction, really scary. Like, there's some really scary moments. Oh. Ciara was like, she had to like take a break afterwards because she wouldn't go back to bed. Like, I went to bed alone that night because she was like, I need a break. I need to just like play my video games and just like
See, that vibe doesn't come from the poster. To me, looked like almost like a teen, young teen zombie
film. And that's where it goes wrong. That's where the marketing goes wrong. But it's a really, really mature zombie film with a lot of great visuals. And the soundtrack is so good. I immediately like bought half the score when I was done. So
also based on a book.
Also based on a
book.
That
I also read.
Yeah.
Where do you find the time?
You're like our literary.
I read a lot, actually. But the book is, if you want a book recommendation, it's horrifyingly scary.
And I heard they're writing a prequel or something.
Oh, I can
now.
See that because they start post-infection.
Post-infection, yeah.
So it's like, you know, they've already, you know, contained the infection as much as they can, and they're dealing with these, like, these kids.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's very, like, you know.
Well, that's one way to go about that, because with Walking Dead, you never want to see the infection start ever again, right? Like, that was the problem with World War Z. You're like, fuck, we already have been here in so many movies in Romero's world, so it's nice to just start there.
Yeah, and the tropes are there, but, you know, again, how do you separate yourself from every other zombie movie? You just bring some new stuff to the table, and even though it feels a little contrived and a little ripped off from Last of Us, you know, whatever.
Was that before the book, the video game?
The video game is long before long before, I think, the book and the movie, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the book's pretty new. Yeah, it's only a few years old.
Okay.
I looked it up. That's actually on demand now, and it's coming on Blu-ray April 25th.
There you go.
So,
Totally worth watching. It's great.
Let's see. So on my end, so last week I watched some pretty good artsy stuff like Wild Tales and Pretty Poison. Mm. This week is the complete opposite, where I've watched things of very questionable
total trash
taste. And no one delivers total trash like our friends at Severn.
Yes.
Did you watch Ursula?
No, I watched.
I ordered this today on Amazon, so you better deliver the goods and make it sound really good.
Drive-In Massacre.
Yes.
All right, so a little thing called Drive-In Massacre shows up in my doorstep, and I'm like, oh, I've never even heard of this. I pop it in. First of all, as you all know, this is a winner for me. It's a lean 74 minutes.
Nice.
So I'm like, great. I could do
wait, you're pro. I could do this.
Feels
you're
like
pro
300.
Shorter the better.
74
listen,
is it.
Listen, you hit me with 82, right. And I'm like, this
too
is
much.
Perfect.
Does that even go under 90. 82's perfect.
82's like the perfect length.
But when people are going like 110, you're like, too much movie.
Well, I think Elric said, I don't know where you're quoting it from, saying that the first 90 minutes are free, every minute after that you got to earn.
Yeah. I forgot who that was. It's somebody, yeah. So it's somebody.
It's the greatest, because you feel it. Once you hit the 90 minute mark, you feel it. You're like,
yeah. I'm kind of with you, actually.
How much longer is this movie going to be? But anyway,
that's why I love kids' movies now, because you don't realize it, but like things like Finding Dory and Trolls, they're made shorter for kids' attention span, and I love that with Sid watching movies with my kids, because I'm like, I'm in, I'm out, I'm done.
Not Harry Potter. Those things were
lasted forever.
I'm scared to start.
But
those movies.
Is 74 minutes even technically a feature anymore?
I think it's 72. I think there actually is.
There's the cutoff.
I thought it was like 76.
Because I know in order
H2O
to get
H2O hardly got there. I remember that Halloween H2O when I started in theaters. I went home and go, is this a feature film? And I typed it up and I was like, okay,
it's a really good pitch.
When I was doing distribution for Fango, I know that there were a couple couple things that were sent to us that we were like, this is only like 68 minutes long. I don't think it's going to classify. And then I always got, can we put a driving scene in? And it's like,
well, I mean, that's what they did. That's what Corbin credits. Used to do, yeah. Right? Add another 10 minutes
little
to TV
bit
movies.
More on those credits. Yeah. Then we're good.
Yeah.
Lay it on me.
Write right, a new song.
Give me some Driving Massacre.
From what I understand, this is from 1976 and it's a slasher. Is that correct? You have your computer in front of me.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like it's 70s, but that would mean that it's way before like Halloween and all the ripoff movies that came in the 80s, because it feels very much like an early 80s movie. But basically, there's no real plot other than there's a bunch of people that go to a drive-in that very randomly get attacked by a guy with a sword.
Yep.
A sword?
76.
A sword.
What type of sword? That's are we talking like broadsword or like dagger?
It's, a sword.
Or?
It's just a giant sword, like a fencing sword,
like,
I guess.
Like any explanation of where he got the sword?
Listen, Bria, there's no explanations in this movie.
Great.
At all. In fact, there's red herrings.
There's time for it.
Is it a rusty sword?
It's a big Hamlet fan. Backstory is not
there's
needed.
There's a Civil War scabbard.
Oh.
That's completely different than like a broadsword.
The best review I can give of this movie, because it's not necessarily like good. It's not a gem. It's not a pieces. It's got it's of its time. It's got actors that are not good, but it's shot on film, so it looks good. And the thing is this. You feel the length in between the kill scenes, but when the kill scenes happen, they're so awesome that like I think I Instagrammed one.
Yeah.
It was like the first one. Like I'm watching the movie.
Dude, that's literally what drove me to Amazon. And I was like,
it's like 5 minutes into the movie and like a dude is making out with his girlfriend in the drive-in and he's like reaching out to fix the sound thing, whatever, and you just see the sword, it's like whoosh, and his head comes right off.
Nice.
And there's just a stump, and she's like, ah! And then he stabs her right through the neck, and it's kind of like that weird, like, what am I watching?
So I'm looking at the poster, Rob.
Yes.
Was it filmed entirely in blood-curdling gore color?
Sure.
That sounds like Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Well, I was going to say.
Second Herschel Gordon Lewis
But a little
reference.
More, yeah.
It feels to me, looking at the poster for it, and the fact that this is blood-curdling gore color, this feels less about, like, slasher Halloween kind of thing.
Yeah.
And more about being the children of, like, H.G. Lewis.
Driving leftovers.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually really funny because it connects next to the other movie I saw. I'm just going to talk about it really quick since they're both together, because the one thing I can say is that they give you an explanation or they start to give you an explanation and they're like, nope, that's not what it is. So it's one of the most WTF endings where you're like, what? Yeah. And it ends at that 74 minute mark. So you're like, well, I guess that's it. Right. So be it. But the reason I bring this up is because the other movie I watched was a 1971 movie called The Zodiac Killer.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
That was put out by Something Weird.
The American genre film. Whatever it is in Austin, you know, who preserve all these films. They saved that one and put it on TCM.
Why?
It's a perfectly fine question. Everything deserves a life, Rob.
Listen, so that's what happened with this one is I went to my buddy Scott Reynolds' house this weekend and we were planning on watching a movie and I get there. We're going to do like a film noir, just something like, you know, really artsy and intelligent. And then he's like, oh, I taped this thing off TCM.
I had it taped off.
He's
too,
like,
yeah.
Dude, I watched the first 5 minutes and I'm like, I can't watch this alone. I need to share this with somebody. So he showed me the first 5 minutes. I'm like, all right, we're watching this again. Yes. What's weird about it is this was happening during the Zodiac killings. And
yeah,
it's
so
like,
they didn't know what was actually going to happen. They had no ending or conclusion.
Oh, my God. But no, but they do like – so first of all, it's the most misogynist movie I've ever seen in my life.
Was this a Something Weird
release? Yes, it absolutely was. On a triple bill.
I've seen parts of it, but I didn't watch the whole
thing. It's one of those films – the one cool thing about it, even if it's a terrible movie, is that it's one of those films that would have actually been lost, like where the film print is going to die to the point where no one can ever watch a movie again.
Yes.
And so they did save it. So that's a cool thing that they do.
Which it's pretty is unbelievable. Cool, you know? But basically, you know, it's taking place during the Zodiac killings. I think there's an opening title card that says, you know, made with the cooperation of Paul Avery, the guy that Downey Jr. plays in the movie.
Oh,
jeez.
Yeah.
Like so this is all happening while the Zodiac killers happen. But anyway, so they introduce you to like a mailman who's kind of like this good-looking suave dude, but then he cries when his bunny rabbit dies. And then like this like really misogynist like truck driver. And they're leading you to believe that the truck driver is like this, oh, maybe he's the Zodiac. Look how mean he is or whatever. And then literally out of nowhere, like they shoot down the truck driver because he gets in a domestic dispute. And rather than give up, like he just is like, I'm the Zodiac, and they shoot him. And then the mailman's the Zodiac. like then it's just like, nope, no surprise at all. This is the dude. He's the Zodiac killer. So then the second half of it is kind of recreating stuff that sort of happened, but not really. But it's like, it's totally like this mailman guy.
It's hard to
get
to the second half.
What am I watching? This is just the most bizarre thing. So
and
it's
that
not,
bar scene where they're with the woman and they treat them terribly and they're pulling the wig and it's
the
ugliest.
The truck
creatures.
Driver has has a wig.
Wait, you know it's a wig?
Yeah, he puts it on.
Yeah. He puts it on.
It's like a Trump hairdo. It's that
I
one
see.
Of weird.
Very much so.
Because he's incognito.
Not yet.
Bill Murray at the end of Kingpin.
Yeah.
He's incognito and he's like trying to hide.
No, he thinks it makes him look bigger, better to
for
pick
girls.
Up. Because when we go to the bar,
to go
he's
them.
Got like four girls with him. No, this is the truck driver. He's just a woman.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Right.
He goes
right.
up to the mailman. He's like, hey,
come
man, I got more girls than I can handle. You want to come over and help me out?
As men do. Like, so what men do.
Yep.
You know?
Keep up. Keep up with the Zodiac.
Look, it's based on a true story, Bria.
Now, have you read those parts?
Like, how do you get the rights to that?
Something tells me.
If it's happening in the news, you don't have to. Like, if it's a. Because also, there was no life rights to get because no one knew who the Zodiac was. So it's like a mass killer.
Well, again, it was still happening. So it kind of ends abruptly. And like, me and Scott are like, did the Zodiac killer go and see this movie and be like, yeah, that mailman looks better
than me?
That's
such a great idea.
Yes. Or did he watch the movie and go, yep, I quit?
Yeah.
He was actually a mailman.
That's who they think I am.
No, I want him to be a mailman. He's like, oh, fuck. Got to quit that job. He's like, ooh, get
the He's like literally in his mailman like outfit.
So those are my questionable picks of the week.
Yeah, that movie is questionable. And I didn't even talk about it on the show. It was so questionable like a few months ago. You know, I saw a movie that I can recommend to people as the best fucking movie of the year because it was made by Blumhouse. And our podcast from Blumhouse, and it's the only reason I'm telling you this.
Heck
Get Out is just a phenomenal, enjoyable home run of a directorial tour de force by a guy who has a completely unique voice, and I loved everything about it. I loved not knowing what that was going to happen beat to beat, and then occasionally knowing what happened, and that thrill you get when you work something out a second before they reveal it. That movie, I feel like that's missing. And funnily enough, the last movie I kind of felt that way about. So now I'm the ultimate kiss ass. Is my other favorite Blumhouse films, and these are now my two. Is The Gift. I think The Gift is wonderful.
Oh, Gift is great
at giving you those turns as it goes. But this is a much even more assured vision because it feels more in line with an episode of Black Mirror in a positive way than it does just a horror film. It feels like it's so sleek and well put together and it's just tremendous. And I'm kind of blown away that he just led with that, opened with that.
I know. Can you believe? I mean, his first movie is kind of like out of the gate. That's really insane. It was the first time. I don't know where you saw it, but I went to like this artsy theater on the east side, and it was the first time I went to the theater. And I like bought my ticket before I went to dinner, and they were like, "Oh, get here early because it's gonna sell out." And I was like, "A horror movie is gonna sell out at this like artsy movie theater?" And they were right, and they like were very strict about checking our ticket. And I was like, it was a completely like packed house.
Wow.
And it was a totally different audience that I normally see at horror movies. And so that was really fascinating.
That's fun itself,
And you could tell everybody was really enjoying it too. It wasn't like because I know they went because it has like this political message, and maybe also because Jordan Peele did it. You know, there's like a lot of reasons they were there, but you could tell everyone loved it because they walked out of the theater and people were literally talking to each other about it. Like people I didn't know were talking to each other about it or talking to me about it. It was amazing.
Yeah, and it has a character, and I'm not going to give any spoilers, but it does have a character who in an average typical horror film would be the reason the film sucks. Mm-hmm. Like that character, you're like, oh, you're bringing this, you're giving us that comic relief character, and in this, it's just the funny most I've laughed out loud all year.
Yeah, so
like,
good.
Pure joy. Yes. Pure joy watching that movie, and it makes me really
happy.
I'll
never think of Jeffrey Dahmer the same.
Oh my God, so funny.
Eyes wide shut, man.
And in general, the casting's really fascinating, and I do think it'll be a fun movie, just like a good Twilight Zone or a Black Mirror. It'll be a fun movie to revisit a second time because you'll have a different take on it.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking forward to that. But
it's
exciting
for me. Caleb Landry, at moments, I was like, I didn't know what to make of him because he's so off-putting.
No, he's the
young son.
Last
Exorcism.
Oh, he's so scary.
Yeah, like
from the
moment he enters screen.
X-Men First Class.
He is?
An antiviral,
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I also just want to say I just looked her name up because I couldn't remember, but Betty Gabriel is like my new favorite actress.
Betty Gabriel's MVP here.
I know because I was watching and I was like, she's also in The Purge, The Last Purge.
Oh, no, I know who you're talking about now.
And she's,
she works for the family.
Yeah.
She's incredible and a much underutilized actress, and people need to put her in way more movies because she pulled off in that movie was when you watched her, you were like, what is going on with this person?
She was one of the creepiest parts by far.
She was amazing.
Just her screen
and
presence.
Such a different role from what she did in The Purge. Mm-hmm. Like, she just, you can see how she has such great range.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's just nice to see, like, casting against type and to see a movie where a black character isn't just the sixth other character in a slasher film who gets a couple scenes before being killed like everyone else. It's like it's actually exploring a subject and exploring identity while also being scary. And I don't think it's about being political, like as we talk later on, but I think it's about making a great horror film that also happens to be have its roots in political things that aren't discussed and maybe should be, you know?
Right.
And it just has a lot of power. It's a great
movie.
Well,
the one, and then we'll get into this a little bit later, but there's nothing wrong with a little diversity in your cast. And I liked following these characters around because I remember, you know, not to throw the movie under the bus, but I'm about to, you know, me and Ryan went to see Rings a while back. Mm. And my problem with Rings is like, it was the blandest two leads I've ever seen in my life. And I remember thinking to myself, I was like, is there no reason that, you know, that the boyfriend can't be a black guy or that the girlfriend can't be like an Asian woman or just something with diversity. Those two characters were like the throwaway best friends for 10 seconds in the background. He literally had a black and Asian friend. Yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm so uninvested. Like, and look, I'm a white dude, but like, I'm so uninvested in this movie because it's just so bland. And I think I hope that Get Out proves that we're kind of ready to just see human stories.
And even beyond that,
or just a healthy, realistic depiction of our world.
Because it's the opening scene, I think you can talk about it a little more, but it just opens with the black guy walking down in a neighborhood that's really wealthy and stuff and feeling uncomfortable.
I love that it did that because I don't know if it makes us think, you know, I don't know if I've ever felt, I felt scared for that character.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I've ever thought of that before seeing it depicted in a movie that way. You know what I mean?
But there's one thing to just like interchange when you're casting, which I do think is a really progressive, interesting thing to do. That's how Lethal Weapon got made. And one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard about casting where Richard Donner was just like, I'd never thought of the character as black ever. Didn't even cross my mind. And then when somebody put Danny Glover in to read for it, and I was like, no, I can't be Danny Glover because he's black. And I just realized how bad that sounded, and I let him read. And then I was like, realized how much of an idiot and how we're all somewhat racist inside, not in the overt sense, but in the way where we have walls. Mm. So that's one way. But what's really why this movie's so great isn't just like flipping the casting. It's writing, giving people some meat to tap into who they are and what their experiences are, because they are different.
Yeah.
And they have been viewed differently by society, and they haven't been represented on a screen. And so when you take those things into factor, suddenly you get something new. You get to explore something fresh, and it really is different, I think, in that level. Yeah. I mean, you go through and you go, how many actual horror films are about being black? And you can come up with freaking like three or so, Ganja and Hess, and you're really scratching the barrel of trying to find stuff. Whereas Night of the Living Dead, you know, obviously is as bold as it gets, I think, with casting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was what, how
at
many
the
years
time.
Ago?
Yeah, 1968, at the time where MLK had just been killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It kind of amazing, but yeah.
What else have you guys seen?
I don't know if I can follow up Get Out with this one.
Try.
Okay, guys, I watched Orgy of the Dead.
All right, you're right.
I know. So I was going on the Splatcast podcast, which you were also on already.
Is this what they were doing?
They were doing
Hey, Rob.
What's up?
Why are we on the Splatcast?
They'll be on your next
episode. I'm sure.
What's going on here?
Mike, Sarah, call them. But yeah, so I was going on the Splatcast to talk about Plan 9, and I realized while researching Plan 9, I was like, I've seen most of Ed Wood's stuff, a lot of it kind of in clips and fast-forwarding and things like that. But I remembered renting Orgy of the Dead when I was a teenager, but I couldn't remember a single thing in the movie. And so I was like, I'm going to rewatch that sucker. And then I remembered why I couldn't remember a single thing in the movie. When you're 16 and you're walking out of the video store with something called Orgy, it's like, holy crap, they're letting me leave the store with this. And then you get home, and the setup is that two teens are watching this hell manager. I don't even know what he is. He's not Lucifer exactly. He's just like a god of some type, evil dude.
A night custodian of hell.
Exactly.
Or something.
As he has all of these women dance before him. And then after a while, they realize that the two teens are watching, and then they tie him to a tombstone and force them to watch, but then they don't want to watch anymore because it's evil. And there's also a mummy, a vampire, and a werewolf, just for good measure.
Mm. Right.
And I know. And Criswell plays, because it's an Ed Wood film, he plays the main guy, the demonic dude. And then you get to the actual dances, which is like the main part of it, is like all of these women are forced to dance in this sense. They're all topless. Well, the majority of them are topless. And that it literally comes down to topless ladies, very bored, grinding on a pile of mulch.
Isn't this during like Ed Wood's really depressed, really sad days?
I'm going to assume so. And I'm getting to that and why I would say that. Okay. So this is 1965. So this is a couple of years after Plan 9. And I do have to say filmmaking has improved since Plan 9. But only 2 degrees, because most of it's still just a stagnant camera. I mean, set pieces aren't falling over and people are actually like saying their lines, but it's still an Ed Wood film. It's better made than Plan 9, but whereas Plan 9 kind of like you wanted to give it a hug because it had so many scars, this you're just like, man, there's just nothing going on here. So it's like the most boring orgy ever. And I'm watching it. And each one, it's strangely...
Boring orgy? Those two words don't feel like they could be together.
Watch it. It's a very boring orgy. I'm watching it and I'm realizing like it's literally just these dance numbers with these topless women on a pile of mulch that's supposed to be a graveyard. And you're watching it and you're realizing like none of these women have any rhythm. They have no emotions. They have no expressions. And then I'm suddenly like, they're not even hearing the music. No one has that little rhythm. Like, I guarantee that they were dancing in silence. And you can see them being directed while they're dancing. And each one of them has one dance move. Like, this is the girl who does turns. This is the girl who dances with the skull and kisses it. This girl shapes her hips like this. And
this Dancing with the Stars column.
I've been in sad strip clubs like this.
Are they dead?
They're
the women?
Supposed to be. Some of them are dead and some of them are supposed to be like sinners who have been forced to be there. Because like, and this is
Bria's
where it gets...
Bria's looking for the motivation.
Yeah. Is the death the motivation?
Isn't this like, you know, like the Lords of Acid's demons? You know, that would be cool and visually tantalizing, but it's literally, and they each have a theme, which is where it gets strangely racist, because they're like, this is the Spanish one. Her matador husband was killed and she longs for his death. Jesus. And then there's a Native American one. No. And
a strangely racist boring orgy.
Just
to cut to the chase, guys.
Yeah. Way better title, by the way.
That's kind of it. But you say, isn't this Ed Wood's kind of sad days? And what's weird is this, for me, was the clearest indication that there was something slightly askew with his sexuality. Because this is like some guy's version of what he thinks is sexy. And it just ends up missing the mark enough to be really bad.
He loves sex with women. He just likes to wear their clothing.
But they're not having, sex at all, though, right?
No, it's
so
just grinding.
It's also what he thinks an orgy is.
Yeah. And so that in itself, but there's just, it's like, it's an psychological examination into somebody who feels like he is trying to understand what this would be, but it just misses it by a little bit. So it's kind of an interesting movie.
I think you just
gave
that movie more airtime than anyone on the
history
planet. History of the world. But that should be an extra feature on that disc.
Probably still like 1 minute.
Even that 1 minute was enough.
Well, the poster does say for adults only.
There is a lot of breasts in it.
A lot of breasts.
It's actually a cool poster.
Yeah.
Wow. How do I follow
that? What else you got?
Get out, Orgy of the Dead.
File this also under Questionable Horror Consumption Week. I on a whim, just decided to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning.
McConaughey connection with Frailty.
No.
Oh, is that not the McConaughey one?
No, that's the prequel to the remake.
The Next Generation. Yes. This is the 2006 prequel to the 2003 remake that was directed by Jonathan Liebsman of Ninja Turtles fame.
So it was like the second one of the reboots.
Darkness Falls.
It was the second. Yeah. Darkness Falls.
Darkness Falls. Tooth Fairy.
Bringing it back.
It's got quite a record.
One of the best audio commentaries ever. Yeah, it was on HBO Go. It was late one night. I was like, you know what? I haven't seen this in forever.
It leads with an excuse.
Because I like that it's like his late night. And he's like, well, I guess I'm going to watch bad horror. Most people are like looking up their most embarrassing porn. And you're like, my most embarrassing thing is to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the beginning.
What is embarrassing porn?
I don't know. I guess it's that Orgy of the Dead movie. Orgy of the Dead.
Very bland porn.
We're on point today. You know what? It's been literally years since I've seen the movie. It's been a long time. And, for a good reason. The movie is just ugly. It's just an ugly, unexciting, and not very fun movie.
What year was this?
06.
So this was literally at the height of the torture.
And, I didn't mind the 03 remake. I haven't seen it again in years. But I was of the belief at the time, hey, I'm down for a new beginning. Let's see what happens. But right from the get-go, you've got this woman in a meatpacking facility, and she's giving birth on the floor to Leatherface.
Yeah.
And then thing you know, this woman is like rifling through the trash, and she finds baby Leatherface in the trash. So you've already, in the first 5 minutes, really set the tone.
Oh, yeah.
And does he look a particular way? Or?
Well, you barely see him, but he's kind of like a mangled
guy. Who wouldn't watch that series, Baby Leatherface? I would watch the shit out of Baby Leatherface.
I would watch
it. I'm into it.
Leatherface.
Yeah.
But man, oh man, what an ugly movie. Diora Baird, you got Jordana Brewster. Oh, but the best thing is, I realized the revelation is, you know who basically incites Leatherface to start wearing skin, to start wearing faces?
Oh.
The most beautiful man on earth, Matt Bomer.
Oh.
Matt Bomer plays one of the victims in this film.
And
if you remember him, he's also in American Horror Story. He shares a lot of screen time with Lady Gaga in American Horror Story Hotel. He's a good-looking dude. I saw him at Sundance recently, and I was like, oh, I'm kind of smitten by your face, dude.
Oh, wow. He is a good-looking dude.
Exactly.
I forgot about
him.
But
I love that it is Matt Bomer's beauty that forces Leatherface to go, I want to wear that face.
That's cool.
That face is so good looking. I'm going to put it over my own.
Seems legit.
Yeah. He stepped up with Eric Balfour in the next movie.
Sure. He's like, look at this one.
Jesus. But anyways, by the end of the movie, I was just kind of like, I was just exhausted by its like nastiness.
It's a
miserable experience. I mean, like, at least Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, even Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, there's a little bit of glee that can be had,
I watched Get Out, because this is the most not good movies we've ever reviewed on a show. I think that's like four that we're all bummed
about.
I'm
about to go on an upswing.
Oh, okay.
Let me go back around, but yeah. Anyways, that's what I watched. I'm probably never going to see it again.
Wow. Elric, anymore?
The one that we can just mention people to see it, but we don't have to go in depth just because it's not really horror. And I know you liked it too, which is Macon Blair's, from definitely not horror.
Oh, on Netflix.
Yes.
I don't even think it's French horror. It's black comedy all the way. It's Coen Brothers, all joy.
Very Coen Brothers.
Early Coen Brothers. But it is really fun. And I actually think it's the most I've ever liked Elijah Wood in anything, because I think he's cast in an offbeat way that was just so much more fun to watch him in this role.
Sure.
And I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very different from the Saulnier Blair collaboration. But still, you can see kind of the violent black comic side of that, but not the serious.
The name, you haven't said the title for our listeners?
Because I don't want to say the title out loud.
I don't feel at home in this world anymore. Yeah.
And Melanie Linsky's always great.
She's great, man. And you know what's funny is one of the villain guys is David Yao from The Jesus Lizard.
Weird.
It's a band I used to love in the
90s.
Yeah,
I remember the band.
Jesus Lizard.
It's the weird, the most surreal thing, because my roommate's a big fan. He walked in on a scene where Derek Mears, Jason, is punching him and knocking. So he's like, is that Jason fighting the singer from Jesus Lizard? And I'm like, why, yes, I never thought I'd hear that, but yes, it is. So kudos for that.
Nice. Wow. I will say it's a surprise it won Sundance, because tonally that is not the kind of movie that wins Sundance.
I know.
Like, I was kind of floored by that. It's like, wow.
Very,
okay.
Very weird.
But hey, more power to it, because we love his stuff. So,
yeah. What else did you guys see?
I'll just add Riverdale, even though it did go pretty CW.
The fourth or something?
Yeah, the fourth episode, but I'm still there. I'm into
it. Are you watching Riverdale?
You know what? I'm not, but I should be, because I feel like I would like it.
It's really fun.
Yeah, it feels like something I'd totally be into.
It's
get
really
it on your
sleazy.
Phone now. Just watch while we do
that. Is that fine? I'm going to check out.
It's so sleazy. Can I tell you, I'm going to make a confession here on the show. Forgive me. There comes a moment. I know Ryan likes to say all the time, old man Turk, when you're talking about stuff.
Yes.
There comes a moment when you realize, like, holy shit, I kind of am old.
Yeah.
And I realized that watching Riverdale this week. I'm all caught up. I'm watching the, you know why? Because I've said it before. Like, I love Veronica. I'm like, oh, I love the chick that's playing Veronica. And yet again, my roommate walks in the room and he's like, who's that? She's hot. And I was like, oh, that's Veronica's mom. And I said it in such a dismissive way. like a teenager, like, that's Veronica's mom, but she's not like Veronica. Ew. And then, like, we were talking about it. I was like, wait a minute. Like, I bet you Veronica's mom is probably my age.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah.
But Veronica may also be your I'm age, knowing how TV casting goes.
That's true.
TV casting is weird. You
but
know?
I looked it up, and I was like, Veronica's mom, who is a very attractive woman, by the way, and up. I would totally date if she was available. But she's going
she's
out.
Putting it out there.
She's
putting
anybody email listening. Address. Anybody is ROB.
She's 2 years older than me. Whereas Veronica is like 22.
What's Veronica's mom's name?
I forget it, but the thing, you know, on the show, she's Luke Perry's after, so I know I have no chance, even in a fantasy. So that's why
Hermione Lodge.
There you go. But anyway,
so this Nichols.
Well, also Mad Chenomic plays a mom in that, and I've had
this
the biggest
is true,
crush
and
on
I love
yeah.
her too.
Mad Chenomic.
But
forever,
do you know what I mean? Like I had that
no,
moment
that is really funny
where I finally realized, like, oh wait a minute, that's weird to crush on the main. Like I'm actually the age of the mom now.
Oh no, yeah, you're being just creepy by crushing man. On the. You're being creepy
you're being
by crushing on the girl.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bria.
You're crushing on a 16-year-old.
Yeah. I'm not. No, fictional 16. Not you know.
Get
it's
him,
like
girls.
A comic book
character.
Come on.
Luke Perry is still incredibly attractive.
You know he is.
There you go. I don't have a shot with him. He's going after the mom. I can't.
Yeah,
he's
trying to get in with Marisol.
You know, like
there's a lot of inappropriate relationships in this show.
There are.
So there you go. I'm just going with the vibe of the show,
quite frankly. Sure. But yeah, it's still fun. I'm having a blast with it.
There Robin Givens is on this show?
Yeah, man.
Huh.
She plays the mayor, right?
Yep.
Sweet. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Brian, what else you got?
I finally caught up to my Arrow Blu-ray of Creepshow 2.
Hey.
Now, I've always been on the negative side of Creepshow 2, but I actually saw the value in it this weekend when I sat down and ate some pancakes and chilled out. You'll see the
I like that you always set the tone for
us.
I was eating pancakes, guys, and you'll find the running theme that weekends are for pancakes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I give Creepshow 2 a pass this time.
It's good.
Which was your favorite segment this time?
The Raft is still my favorite.
The Raft is great.
Yeah. I love the last two, though. I like both of them. But.
The Raft is still my favorite. I realize now why the hitchhiker story, I remember watching, because my introduction to Creepshow 2 was, you know, Turek family, you know, sitting around watching a VHS. And I remember the woman, you know, she's coming out of this affair and she's driving home talking like very R-rated. And I never understood it as a kid, but I remember my dad just sitting there going, oh, come on. Why is she saying this? Right, go to your room. And I was like, oh, but I want to know what's happening. And anyways, it's fun. The first one is the weakest one. It is so ridiculous. But you know what? You know, Creepshow 2 and the Raft story basically presents a fucking creeper of a character. That kid on the raft is almost basically a rapist.
Well, he's like remember the guy from The Blob? I always think of that character, the friend character who tries to get
absolutely.
Yeah, same
I completely
kind of thing,
forgot that he tries
cabin
to,
fever.
He like tries to like sleep creep on this like poor girl on the raft.
Yeah.
And then, you know, his sin is, oh my God, I'm gonna watch her face get torn off, and then I'm gonna jump into the lake and I'm gonna get eaten. But it's like, oh my God, you're a rapist. Go
it's
die.
Inappropriate. It's
inappropriate. Yeah. Totally. But I mean, like, whatever.
Well, the Blob gets it anyway.
Yeah. But I mean, like, where does that come from? I just didn't even like realize who gave the note to like sleep creep on somebody. Anyways.
It's kind of sad that as like 13-year-old boys, we don't notice that as creepy.
Yeah.
And then now, thank God, as older men, we are at least catching up to having pride
it's
of some
so
kind.
Weird. Anyways, it's a fun sequel. The wraparounds are great. I forgot how much fun the animated stuff is, but yeah.
And Savini is the creeper in the
Savini
second one.
Is the overacting creeper.
And John Harrison directed all three?
Yeah, I think so. He did that one, Who's normally his composer, Romero's composer.
No kiddies! And he's like, all that big hand gestures.
I still think that would be the coolest series. A series
creep show would be the best
property to have.
Yeah. Sci-fi was supposed to do that a long time
Remember they did
ago.
A web series, like way back in the day, me and you reviewed a bunch of web series for Shock. And
who was involved with that? Was somebody from that 70s show. Somebody from that 70s show was involved in it.
It wasn't good, though. Huh. They were trying to launch it as a web series, and it just wasn't good.
My bet's Valderrama. That Valderrama.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. Yep.
Boom. Is that everything we've seen? Have we hit? All right, so let's listen. Before anything, because ironically enough, today One of the people on our group, Jennifer Lovely, posted about how we should be political when it comes to horror. Or am I getting that message right? Or
I didn't see what she was responding to because she sounded like she was annoyed with
something. It was that horror is going to be political.
No,
sorry,
it was more of there's been a weird backlash on social media and on websites when there's an attempt to talk about political horror films or horror films that tackle political subjects. People are firing back going, I just want my horror pure and raw. No. Yep. And her message, I believe, because I did see it in passing while I was kind of running around, it was, hey, look, horror films are political. No matter what you say, you know, you're always going to find something or there's going to be something there.
Yeah.
So it's like, so just like understand that even though there's probably a horror movie that you absolutely love that you don't think is political, more chances are not that there is a political side to it.
Not intent.
Sometimes it's just in the reading.
And I think there's backlash that people think that, you know, there's going to be this glut of overly political horror movies. But whatever. That's a good kickoff to the conversation.
There are people that will get online and say that they don't want these messages in their horror, that horror is supposed to be escapism and things like that. But I mean, like,
totally fine.
Even on our own Facebook page, we had an article that we posted up right after the election called The Body Politic, which examined politics through horror. It was written by Clay Chapman, who's like absolutely amazing. And the comment thread under that, like we had to really closely monitor it because we were getting people like, fuck this fucking shit. Like because it was immediately political, people were angry. And it wasn't even like right or left leaning. It was just like discussing political horrors in general and like throughout history and the different movements that have occurred. And yeah, but it was like instant anger.
I mean, I think the point for this discussion today is that we are not going to push any sort of our personal political beliefs forward. We're just having a discussion about how it relates.
I'll say whatever the hell I
want to
say.
You do. But you know what I mean? It's like that's not the point.
It's not about agenda. It's about what entertainment's being used for or what you – look, it's all fucking objective, you know? And it's all about what you want to read into it. Now, there was one comment I saw where it was like – somebody said something like, oh, next they're going to tell me that Texas Chainsaw Massacre doesn't have like a political view. And it's like, well, you're kind of wrong because it came out – a lot of those films that came out at that time are coming out of fucking deep anger of Vietnam.
Vietnam, for sure.
And they're coming from a place – Last House on the Left and Wes Craven, everything that Tom Savini was dealing with. You know, it George Romero in 68, it's like – It's always going to be coming from somewhere. It's going to be coming from fear.
Real fear is something most of us don't often live through.
And I think it's also easier to look back like on something like that because art reflects what's happening at the time. All art, horror movies are included in art, obviously. And I think, it's easier to look back and go, oh, these movies from the 60s and 70s, these reflect something that's happening at the time. I think now we think they aren't reflecting things that are happening, but they are. They are infused with our politics of the day, whether or not we mean them to be.
Right. And it's a risky thing to do in the current time to make your film like that because in retrospect, Texas Chainsaw Massacre isn't risky. It's obvious, right? Of course they would do something political because we're kids in the 80s who didn't live through that. But to make something at the time where people are being locked up, to cast a black man in the lead of Night of the Living Dead is like right after JFK has been assassinated and Martin Luther King. These are ballsy things and because you're making them because you have no other choice, right? These are made by people who had something to say.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that's ultimately what a lot of this comes down to, including Get Out, is like, this is a film made by somebody with something to say, not just somebody who said, I need to make my next movie.
And I think most directors have something to say. I mean, I would like to think, even if it's maybe not necessarily something they're considering like political. A political agenda, they definitely have something to say about the culture of their time, mm-hmm. which inherently, when you look back, becomes politicized.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, one of the best documentaries that really opened my eyes to, I always knew it just from talking to horror fans and examining the movies that I grew up with, but The American Nightmare, which is Adam Simon's documentary.
Yeah. Yes.
And I remember Adam was on Killer Pivy number 113. And I remember because at that time, I don't know if Elric, if you were as familiar with him, but obviously he's the showrunner and creator of Salem. Mm-hmm. So he was coming in and technically our topic was going to be about witches because obviously it ties into his show. But he came in and we spent a great deal of time talking about the American Nightmare and him talking to those filmmakers, and I still think it's one of the best interviews we've ever done on that show, and really eye-opening, because even he was – like, that's the thing. At the time that things like Texas Chainsaw were coming out or Last House on the Left, all that, those filmmakers didn't have – or, you know, didn't have a voice to say that that's what they were referencing. For a lot of them, the first time they were talking about it was in that documentary, The American Nightmare, like in retrospect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, people like Carpenter and all that. So – in terms also, of, I think it's a great, that's a great starting point.
No.
If you want to see something that.
Absolutely. It's like, watch that documentary, see those films, and put yourself in their shoes. Put in that perspective. Bria brings up a great point. They're of their time. But to easily dismiss them as not political or not, or just dismiss them as not having a message or having any kind of viewpoint behind it, I think it's highly wrong.
Are people doing that, though? Are they dismissing
absolutely.
It? Really?
No,
I've never seen that.
Not dismissing the films, but dismissing their value as having something socially conscious to say.
Right.
Yeah,
you know?
I see that with slashers all the time where people just dismiss them as like, yeah, they're great. They mean nothing. But it's important to remember that they are a product of their time. Slashers are inherently Reaganistic, right. where it's mm-hmm. they all fall into a very right-wing category right. where you're punishing sin. And
almost always made by liberals, and it's so interesting. It's true. Yeah. Like the people who made them are of a different agenda, yet they're putting this thing on screen that then is interpreted. Right.
It's
as
the
this
same
thing.
The same thing happened in the 50s, yeah. though, because in the 50s, all the movies are about paranoia of aliens and things like that. Right. But they're being made by the liberals who weren't as concerned.
And they didn't, right, but they were worried about Russians.
Yeah, I know.
The atomic, the atomic era. You know, imagine being a kid sitting in a movie theater or being at the drive-in and watching a fucking nuclear blast open a film about giant ants and or grasshoppers or whatever.
Right.
That is scary at the time. Now we laugh, but it's like, no. Put yourself in the shoes and what was going on at the time. You were afraid of being nuked. You were afraid of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. When you look at it at the time, the movie is about xenophobia.
Mm-hmm. That's, the original one?
Yeah,
originally,
yeah.
Well, and then new one's about the end of the hippie era. I mean, it's the fear. Because it's funny. If you ever know anyone from the baby boomers, they went from being hippies to literally to being bankers.
Yeah.
An entire generation just switched like that. And you're like, how the hell did you do that? Like, how did you make that leap? It was so extreme. But they did. So it always felt like, to me, like a con, you know? Mm-hmm. And that feels like that's a movie just about this one thing, even though it's not. It's about a lot of other things, a lot of other interpretations. But it's interesting. I've just never seen those comments of people looking back going, oh, I don't believe.
There's a couple articles that I've read, where I'm a glutton for punishment and I just kind of dive into the comments every once in a while and I take a look at everything and I'm like,
no.
But look, everything has its place, you know. You could talk about slasher films and the relevancy of them, but then there's like stuff like Drive-In Massacre. It's like, okay, well, maybe there's a place for Drive-In Massacre where it's just a pure, you know, you're being rewarded by the kills. And that's it.
If there's a message in Drive-In Massacre,
I'm saying.
I think that one may have been a product of the other products of the time.
Well, what I'm saying is that there's a time and place and for everything, all entertainment, and some of it leans more towards political, some falls right in the middle, and some leans more towards Drive-In Massacre.
Or Dear the Dead.
And some are subtler than others too. I mean, allegories last longer.
Well, let me ask everyone around the room, what's the first horror movie that you can remember in being aware that there was some sort of social commentary to it? Like, you know, like obviously there comes a point where you're like, oh, there's way more to this movie than just it being cool.
Videodrome. I saw in probably late middle school, early high school. It was like after it had come out. I mean, Videodrome was what, like 82?
Early 80s.
So I didn't see it until like early 90s. But I remember at the time being like, this film clearly has a message. I don't understand what it's saying. Is it saying that we shouldn't use videotapes? Is it saying media is bad or media is good because he's like using media to say long live the new flesh and it's now a new flesh? Like, I was so confused by what the message is. I'm still a little confused by what the message is. But it was the first one that I remember being clearly like, this has a message and I need to figure out what it's saying. Mm-hmm.
I mean, definitely from unquestionably in Night of Living Dead, and only because of the emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was saying anything until the lead gets shot, not because he's a zombie, but because he's black from afar. And then these people like hold him up, just like racist photos of the day, holding up the corpse. If you watch that documentary I was talking about last week, the amendment.
The 13th.
It's the same thing. It's talking about the same thing. And it shocked me. I think I might have been 12 or something. And I remember like having tears in my eyes and not knowing what to do. Like, I didn't know a horror film can end like that.
Really young when you saw the original Night?
Yeah, like 12 or 13. I can't remember. And I saw it colorized. I think I've told you that before. Yeah. It was colorized the first time I saw it, which is terrible. But it was so shocking because you're not used to seeing the protagonist, let alone somebody like that who's done everything right to survive the movie.
Yeah.
And then is just killed. And you're like, oh, but I don't understand why. And so if you can hook someone emotionally and move them, you can push things more forward than making a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's.
What about you guys?
I think Dawn of the Dead for me.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously just about consumerism. You know, as the Night of the Living Dead was.
Yeah.
Well, it was on American soil, and yeah. It was Americans doing things to Americans. Mm, you know, there's that whole sequence where it's just all these hunters, you know, picking off other Americans, you know, who are zombies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an other from another country, you know, right. or someplace that we don't know. It's on our own soil.
That's not very realistic to our country.
It's kind of funny regarding the Romero stuff, though, because most people see it overtly in Dawn. And obviously you were saying Night. When I was a kid, they were, you know, Dawn to me was just, oh, cool, we get to, you know, let's pretend we're fighting zombies in a mall. Like me and my friends would do that, like hiding behind the couches and be like, we're in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
The one that stuck out to me was Day of the Dead. Mm. And I can't really put my finger on it, although – again, I've said before, I think The Walking Dead is totally just Day of the Dead extended.
Yeah.
But it was the idea of a small group unable to agree on a single thing.
And also military-led.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the movie of Romero's movies, where I was like, oh, there's way more to this than just it being a cool zombie movie with gore effects and stuff like that.
I do think that's the most overt, but I also think it's probably because he had a couple films out that had been reviewed as, oh, he does satire, he does this, so by the third one, he actually made it, like, I'm going to give you a message.
I was going to throw Godzilla into the pot. Uh-huh. 54 Godzilla. That was the first one that I saw as a kid, because my dad was showing me all the classic movie monsters, and this was the first one that threw a very stark, violent, grim view on what war can do, you know?
Yeah.
Because once Godzilla goes stomping through, you know, Tokyo, or goes stomping through any village, you know, the camera lingers on the victims. Yeah. You know, you're seeing the cleanup, you're seeing the after effects, and it's like, oh my God, you know? And that, more than anything, it, beyond being, you know, about the outcome of a nuclear blast, it's about war itself. You know, these people at war with this thing that could come at any time and completely destroy your home and your family, you know? And it was like almost kind of like a documentarian approach to some of the shots. In fact, there's the Death Waltz Records release of the soundtrack. There's one track that I can't listen to because it's so depressing, and it's all of the look at the families who are dying because of Godzilla track. And I'm just like, I can't deal with that track. It's too sad. So I just move on to the more hopeful stuff. But that was the first one that I was like, wow. And then it was the Romero trilogy. And I got really bummed out watching that trilogy, because we took it in order: Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead. By Day of the Dead, I got super bummed about humanity altogether, because I was like a teenager. And I was just like, what if this goes down? Like, we are doomed.
We are.
We're all doomed. We're still doomed. That's my view.
I'm just depressed we don't learn from our movies.
I know.
You've made all these movies. We have all these allegories. We should be able to live a very good life now. But we don't learn shit from them.
Well, I do. I mean, there have been studies that have been done that things that they show in movies, which is why I think movies are inherently somewhat political, things that you see in movies, you're more likely to repeat in real life. So if you, like, for example, see like a black president in the movies, you think it's more likely to happen to you in real life, which totally makes sense.
That makes sense.
So everybody saw Deep Impact with Morgan Freeman?
Is that what we're talking about? And then we got to happen. But I do think that we learn from them.
Yeah.
We model our lives after movies way more than we think we do.
Right.
Yeah. Ryan, I have a question for you. When, you know, because you grew up, you know, your dad is a big horror fan and you grew up watching a lot of horror with him, which is not the situation I had.
Right.
But did you guys like, how many times did you and your father have discussions about what was happening in some of these horror movies, or did you talk about it just on a level of like, oh, that was pretty cool? I mean,
no.
Did you get in those kind of discussions with your dad about
No, just because I think maybe my folks – I grew up in a family that didn't talk much about religion and or politics. Mm. So it was a lot of just my own discovery and own analysis as a kid. They Live was probably another one of those kind of like big – formative movies that made me look at politics. I think it came out when I was in middle school, and when I got to school the next day, I was very interested in social studies and whatever was going on. You know,
we would have to read
Time Magazine, you know, and I would just be like, okay, why is this movie making fun of what's going on right now, and what should we?
And because that one's so allegorical, it's what's been happening lately with that film is really interesting to me, because unlike Texas Chainsaw, we're not going to project what we're going through now onto Texas Chainsaw. It's of its time. They Live isn't really of its time. I think it transcends of its time.
So now it feels like it's now.
It's totally current.
But then, you know, what every Carpenter who never comes out of his shell to yell at anyone, right? You can't be bothered.
People were adopting
it and misinterpreting it in a way that made him obviously so upset. Do you remember what the exact...
Somebody wrote something that it was in like his version of being anti-Semitic.
And he was just
And he jumped up on Twitter and he's like, that is...
He's like, this is about Reagan yuppies, you asshole.
Yeah. Like, it was straightforward. He was like, yeah, Reagan
But it really
yuppies,
does feel like
assholes.
A 1% kind of storyline now. Like we watch and go, oh, the 1% controlling the rest of the population. It feels... Which is a sign of a pretty amazing piece of filmmaking, you know, when you can have things that can last and just keep
being
reappraised.
That film, it's just unbelievable, because that's one that I watch every couple of years, and it's like every single time it is completely relevant still. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just one of those like timeless movies that it's like you can totally cite things that are happening now and be like, yeah, it's totally in They Live.
Because you get in a lot of fist fights in alleyways.
That's exactly right. That lasts like 15 minutes long.
They are long.
You know?
Like, so relevant to my life, man.
I remember having discussions about the Twilight Zone episodes with my mom, the original series, because she was such a huge sci-fi fan. But they were always highly political because my mom was an ex-hippie. And I think they would be if given the choice.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think they're there to start a conversation. Yeah.
So I remember even Star Trek, because a lot of Star Trek, I remember watching even like Next Generation with her and teasing the politics out of that and discussing it with my parent. Well, not my dad, my mom.
What's that one Twilight Zone? I forget the name of it, but isn't there one where like there's suspicion that one of the people in the town might be an alien?
I think you're thinking of one called Will the Real Alien Please Stand Up? And it's not a town, but it's set at a diner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's all these people in this diner, and these cops show up and they say, we found an alien spacecraft a couple of miles back, and there's alien tracks that lead to this diner. Yeah. So one of you guys is an alien. And that one's called Will the Real Alien Please Stand Up?
Yeah, there was that. And then the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of. That's the one where shit starts going weird. Like the lights start going off and on.
And they think one of the people are doing it. Right. And it turns out the aliens are just watching.
Yeah.
And it's like you just put fear and doubt in them and they will tear themselves apart.
Yeah, there's that. And then there was one from the 80s revival of Twilight Zone that always haunted me, which was about a housewife who has the power because of something that she has that's able to just stop time. So she can like – she was like a fed-up housewife.
Gets everything done.
She's taking care of everybody. She's, you know, she's got an ungrateful husband. She's got crazy kids and she's always doing something. And then she just has the ability to just go stop and everything just stops. And I think actually it's the mom from A Christmas Story. and at the very end, something happened. Oh, through the whole story, like you're hearing on TV and on the radio something about nuclear escalation between the U.S. and Russia or something like that. And at the very end, something heightens in her dramatic life and she says, stop. And then she decides to go on a walk. And as she's walking through town, everybody is looking up. And then the camera pulls back, and then we pan up to the sky, and there's a fucking nuclear warhead
about to
hit the town.
That's a great story.
I remember seeing
that and just getting chills. I was like, oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
That was one of the best ones of the 80s, I thought.
But it was set in the 50s?
No, it was set in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
But because that was like, you know, that was Cold War era stuff,
yeah,
you know, Rocky IV, you know, yeah. Rocky versus, you know, it's like all of that stuff. And that was
War Games, baby.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Mm. No, but they're all a reflection of their time and what we're fearing.
Yeah.
And some films
don't even need to be overly political. Some films can, you know, comment on stuff that's going on at home, like They Live. Another film that I think is really relevant and profound too is The Wolfen. Now, The Wolfen is just a film about shapeshifters and Albert Finney trying to investigate, you know, the string of murders. But what it's really about is gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
It's about these, you know, these these apartment complexes being raised just outside of, you know, New York and driving out all of these people. And one of the, you know, and it's all about the ancestors of that air, that land, who are now coming back and seeking revenge on the developers, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's just it's a microcosm thing that is set against the backdrop of this procedural that's going on with Albert Finney, you know? That's the stuff people latch onto. They want to see the detective's head roll when a wolf attacks somebody, but going on behind the scenes is fucking anger, you know, about people getting their land taken away.
I think there's something about inherent in horror movies that makes it just an easier pill to swallow when you're talking about these subjects. Like, you can make a movie just about gentrification, and people will see it, maybe even win an Oscar. I don't know. But I think putting it into, like, popular culture, right, having this horror or science fiction bent gets it out there.
Making it entertaining.
Yeah, it's like, entertaining.
Like, I remember it shouldn't get in the way of the entertainment. Like, it shouldn't stop the narrative flow. Like, the one I was probably maybe 16 when this came out, when we were all about that age, was, you know, when Candyman came out. I don't think I was entertained by Candyman, so I wasn't thinking too politically, but it was the first time I realized, oh, he's coming from a different part of town. He's a myth created by a different part of town, different people. And then when it gets to his past, you're like, oh, even his backstory is from America's racist past. He's a monster springing from those roots, and that's pretty amazing. But first viewing, that isn't what I got. I just got a fucking rad horror film.
You're a 16-year-old
but
kid.
Then you get a little older and watch again and go, oh, this is just purely a political horror film. So it's an interesting balance.
I remember seeing that in People Under the Stairs, where the first time you see it, you're just like, what the fuck am I watching? Because there's so much
still like that
in that. But then the second viewing, you're like, there's clearly some racial and class divide stuff going on here. Yeah. But yeah, it's so balls out crazy that it gets kind of buried.
We could do a whole episode on what Ving Rhames is wearing. I don't know what that
is. Well, no, I think you hit a very valid point, is that there could be a political message or a social message in it, but if you just see the movie as a movie, it's still a good piece of art. And obviously one of the most overt of all time that is very relevant is The Dead Zone. Mm. And I've always said, I mean, that's as overt as it gets in terms of the wrong person getting in power and how do we stop them. But I've always said I love it because it's my favorite King novel. It's my favorite Cronenberg movie. And it's my favorite Christopher Walken performance. Yeah. And the reason I love that movie so much, I've said on the show before, is to me, as a kid that grew up reading comic books, that movie's it's the structure of a superhero movie. It's the three acts. Mm-hmm. The act, you know, the first act is the origin. The second is the reluctant hero not wanting to be the hero, but he accepts it. And then the third act is fulfilling your destiny and doing what has to be done. And I always saw it in those terms, even though, again, now it's kind of scary to look at The Dead Zone and be like, wow, if you could stop Hitler, would you do it? You know?
What did Louis C.K. about that? What? You ever hear Louis C.K. special about Hitler? He's always like, people always say they're going to go back in time and they're going to kill Hitler. I wouldn't go back and kill her. I'd fuck Hitler in the ass. I'd give him a good fucking. I would just fuck him. And maybe they would change. And I always just maybe laugh. Just the visual image of Louis C.K. going back and fucking Hitler. Hey, who knows what would happen?
What was it? One of you guys brought up Dreamscape a couple of weeks back. Yeah. Dreamscape also has that kind of undercurrent of political fear and stuff like that, because isn't like a president, I haven't seen it in decades, but doesn't like the president keep having like these awful nightmares of nuclear oblivion?
Yeah, and I thought, if I remember correctly, it was they were trying to manipulate the president in that way through his dreams.
Right. Yes.
You know, so that's there's always that.
I need to revisit that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
But if we had a giant board in front of us with all the horror titles and all the presidents and the kind of the actual periods, it would be pretty interesting, because we're at war in Iraq and we're seeing things like Hostile emerge when questions of us torturing terrorists. Totally. And you're like, it is very overt. But it becomes more interesting than just Hostel the movie. Like, I'm more interested to rewatch Hostel when I think about it in that way than I would just otherwise. Otherwise, I'd never rewatch it again, you know? Yeah. But I'm like, no, they are saying something and they're doing it with entertainment. And it's a weird balance. It's a weird thing to lay down.
One of my absolute favorite ones, which was like an of its time thing, is The Stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's still one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's so like 80s Reaganomics, commercialism.
It's alive too. It's alive is also talking about like fertilizers that are creating, you know, that we are eating things that we don't know about. We're spraying our food with shit we don't know about. It's Alive 1 and 2.
Well, a Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. That little one literally begins with, oh, we got this machine, we're going to start spraying the crops, and all of a sudden,
That's called Let Sleeping Corpses Lie in the States, wow. Ryan. We're America.
Jesus. Call me. No, but I mean, some writers are more like, you know, Carpenter and Larry Cohen, people who are clearly writing with that in mind. It's not accidental. We're not projecting on it with Larry Cohen stuff, right? We had him on the show and he was already pitching us his Starbucks terrorist movie or whatever it was.
Yes. Oh my God.
So it's not accidental. With some art, I genuinely think it's not conscious. Hmm. The director, like Brie was saying, it is coming from them, but I don't think they're as aware of it as somebody reviewing and constructing from a movie, you know, different layers, I guess. Mm.
I've always been a fan of the movies where the government is plotting something or people end up as part of an experiment, like things like Cube. Belko experiment falls into that, although we can't say much about it yet. The Mist, the Crazies, where they're all these kind of like, the government did it.
Yeah.
Like, I've always loved those movies. The Host is one. Of course, in that one, it's also our government. But yeah.
I mean, in terms of Vietnam, I mean, just writing down ones that we love now, I still think Death Dream is just awesome way of looking at that event. It's almost like, I feel like it could be about now. If you're remaking, I feel like it's almost a comment on how we send, you know, our best, youngest, brightest, strongest, we send them away and they come back
shells.
And deformed and broken and like vampires or monsters. And it's really sad. Mm-hmm. And it's because that's a sad horror film. It's not a scary horror film so much as it's sad.
I was going to say, you know, David Scowl, not Scowl, wrote this great book called The Monster Show, and it delves into how films like The Wolfman and Todd Browning's Freaks and all that stuff kind of helped audiences get through like World War One and over, you know, a bunch of other stuff that was going on politically at the time, you know, Freaks being a reflection of the war vets that were coming home completely maimed and deformed. And, you know, there's a great chapter or a great section of that book that really talks about how
that
those
whole
older films.
Just amazing.
Yeah, it's a great book. But it really comments on how those films at the time were also political.
Yeah, I think Jacob's Ladder was the one that made me, you know, because, you know, I don't remember Vietnam, obviously, but that was the one that made me like read up on it and realize the effects of it. I mean, also, it's a scary movie. Like,
and it's based off the real life trials. I think it was an MK Ultra, but there was another one where they were feeding actual. You can look it up on the Blumhouse site.
Oh, yeah, like some experiment.
It was like an experimental drug that they were actually feeding some of the Vietnam troops without their knowledge to kind of gauge what happened to them. And they didn't go all ladder, but they still had some like fucked up side effects.
Yeah, there's a lot of dark stuff. And then there's fun. I mean, society is obviously a very clear, overt about class, and it's fun. Like all of us can identify with, like, why do they get to go to that country club? Why are they like that?
Yeah.
You do feel like you're,
yes.
And it's totally overt, but then they put a play on it and it makes it relevant and fun and silly, you know?
Chud.
Yeah, you're right. Chud was very overt.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like there's just so much diversity and so much range all, you know, these themes can have. You know, you can't just rule out, that's just fun. It's like, no, there's food for thought in these movies.
Well,
you know?
I mean, as class is such a specific one, I think, as well. I mean, the Purge movies are all class.
Oh, totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in such an overt way, but I think that, you know, they're very palatable.
No one listens to the Purge movies either.
That's true. You normalized it. It's your fault. This happened. You normalized them.
We said it was going to happen.
There's also like interesting waves. Like I think the one that you can't just quickly go, oh, this means this, is that whole wave of new French extreme movies. I think is the most interesting thing happening in world cinema at that period, because it's not just a straight hostile thing. It's more about a fear of, it's actually very relevant to what's happening in France right now, which is massive fear of immigration, massive fear of the other, massive fear of borders. And then suddenly all of those movies, for the most part, have some sort of immigrant character, some sort of character on a farm who doesn't fit in, and then something terrible happens and torture. And those movies, I don't know what the pattern is. I know there's a book on New French Extremity, but they're just interesting. And you're like, okay, so this is like all these disparate filmmakers, not kind of like your Splat Pack was being labeled here. They're not purposely initially making stuff to be in cahoots. But you watch together, you realize there is a wave of an idea forming of fear. And that is when the strongest work, I mean, I bet, like I was saying before, if we had a spreadsheet, I bet you all the most interesting things would be happening under a more oppressive government than a happier, positive government.
Yeah. Which brings me to a big realization that I had today while researching all of these political horrors. So you guys know how much I love nun horrors.
Yes.
And I had always...
Nunsploitation.
It's kind of my deal. I had always thought that it was because I was raised in this like anti-religion household. My mom was an ex-hippie, so we didn't really have much religion. And so for me, the only two types of nuns I ever saw was I saw the ones in things like The First Power. And then I saw ones in Sound of Music. So as far as I could tell, like, nuns were these magical singing beings that could, like, fight the devil. And I always thought that that was why I liked nun movies, because I'd always been kind of like, what are these odd creatures? But as I was thinking about political horror films today, I realized that the two things that every single nunsploitation movie has had is fighting sexism and fighting male patriarchal religions. Like, there's even a line in Flavia the Heretic, which is by far one of the most exploitive and grossest ones, where she converts, like, she sheds her nunness and she converts, I think, to being a Muslim. And she has a speech about how she got rid of one patriarchal religion for another. And then I was suddenly like, is that why I like these movies so much? They are so fucking political. Even, like, the most exploitive ones, like Ilsa, when you take a step back, you're like, man, there's some really important politics going on in there. So, yeah. Nun films, guys.
I haven't seen that one. What was it? Flavia?
Flavia the Heretic. Oh, it's
so tied into your kind of like weird underwater amphibious creature subgenre now.
Yes.
Slugs.
Slugs.
What's Slugs about?
Actually, Slugs you could do because it was, it was the government dumping radioactive materials into the sewer.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, like radioactive is basically always the culprit. Well, things that have radioactive content, we're all screwed.
Yeah, like they were dumping shit in the sewer.
All of Wes Craven's early films, you know, Last House is very political. Like, I mean, it's really like something that hadn't been seen yet, talked about much then, which is the dark side of hippies, this dark turn that was happening, like when initially acid good, we're all tripping.
We did that,
and what happens with
bad
acid? Yeah, exactly. And that when it starts to turn, it's really scary. I think it's also just playing with something that no one had seen yet, and by putting up on screen, everyone's suddenly scared and takes a step back at what hippiedom was. And you know, obviously, Hills of Eyes is extremely political about you know, testing and stuff. I don't know. It's these people when they put an idea behind something, I just find it more rewarding horror films. But like I said, it is important not to foreground the idea. Because otherwise it's a detriment to your actual story.
Yes.
I read a theory once that right after the Manson murders came to light and they arrested Charles Manson, that there was this small little enclave of horror films that came out about sinister hippies. Satan's Children was one. And I've always wanted to find like some of the other films that would fit into that subcategory.
Well, and you're also talking about independent film.
Yeah.
A lot of the films we're talking about were independently made, studio-financed horror of these times. 80s is a little different, and Friday the 13th, I don't think they're trying to be political. After the fact.
The 80s stuff was social. It was entering video stores, which means it was all entering our homes, whether we exactly, you know, were asking for it or not. We were seeing all of these things on the video store shelves. So we were more aware of it than something like Satan's Children.
But you were absolutely right. You know, to get that kind of those kinds of movies across, it has to be independently financed. The big studios certainly weren't kind of getting
They're
going to
water down some of those ideas. Right. I mean, you know, I know because, by the way, if you didn't know, we took tonight's topic from, it was very important for me to give them a shout out from our Shockwaves fan club listeners. And I know there's a couple that were like, you know, are horror films inherently misogynist or are slasher films? And that some of these are really fucking hard to answer. Because we can both enjoy something as just a viewer and we don't think about it and then afterwards be critical and go, oh, Jesus, it is. Of course it's – of course this particular – like The Prowler. I could watch it and go, oh, man. Like if I looked at that through that lens, I'd think it's really ugly.
No, actually, Tim Dolan actually had mentioned is horror a feminist or misogynistic medium? And I was like – it's a swinging pendulum.
Yeah.
It depends on the scope.
It depends on the film. It depends on the director's vision, but it is both feminist and misogynistic.
Yeah, because there are times that I will watch films that seem like they should be incredibly, incredibly misogynistic, but due to specific key elements. Like, I can name slashers that I'm like, there's a lot of feminist tones in that. At the same time, I can
the
name...
Final Girl.
Yeah.
Right. But also, and also there can't be a law against you, like you, Becca, enjoying that too. Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
Sure.
So it could be Miss 45 or something, Driller Killer, and you might personally enjoy that. And yet there's another side of you that could critically rip it to shreds.
I would say the Driller Killer actually is quite feminist because in it, he starts going nuts. His girlfriend leaves him to have a lesbian relationship.
There you go.
So, yeah.
And his penis is out of control.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, that's not a bad read of it.
But it's complex stuff. I mean, I think it's stuff that we're not going to solve and people have been writing books on it forever. But it is interesting to think that something can both be entertaining and you could be critical about it. It's worth thinking about.
I was going to say, Bria, what do you think?
Oh, generally?
Answer it right now.
Just throw it down.
Yeah.
Give us an answer. Definitive.
100% nothing. I mean, I agree. I just think it's like you take it on a film by film basis. I don't think obviously anything is going to be inherently feminist or inherently like misogynistic.
It's human. Yeah, it's human.
I mean, I think the one thing I would say is that I mean, often, like, if you have to ever defend horror, which I'm sure no one in this room ever has to do that.
No.
But people are like, but don't you, they kill a bunch of women. Like, isn't that making a misogynist genre? And I'm always like, but there's always a female that survives to the end. And how many movies, what other kinds of movies except for romantic comedies often have females as leads? Have
probably 80% of the films, too. Like it's probably overwhelmingly female-driven.
And they're generally fighting back. They're generally not like some sort of weak female. Now, there are other political issues you can go into there.
Objectification.
Or they're often like white virgins. You know, there's a lot of, you know, other issues.
They say they're virgins. Come on.
Like Jennifer's Body, actually, I think of as a very political movie, like a feminist movie.
Yeah. Teeth was another one.
Oh my God, what a great,
that's
a good
like
feminist.
The ultimate feminist movie.
Have you played a final girl before? Like, have you survived, been the final, literal final girl?
Yeah.
What did you think, growing, both of you, I'm just curious, from your perspective, watching final girls in movies, did you identify it or did you think it was just, oh, they're just the stock character for dudes to watch, you know, run around? How did you grow up watching those kind of slasher movies? I'm curious versus how we see it.
I definitely identify with. I mean, I think when you go in a movie, you identify with one of the main characters. And maybe that's just something with me. It means I have trouble watching some movies. So I'm just like, I didn't identify with anybody in that movie, which is fine. That's the movie you want to make. That's the movie you want to watch. That's great. If you're, you know, you have some sort of horrible, terrible person as your lead, I think that's an interesting thing to do. It's just not necessarily a movie I'm going to watch all of the time. So yeah, I think, like, especially as a teenage girl, you do sort of start watching these horror movies because you see yourself. Like, that's me. I'm surviving till the end, in theory.
Yeah.
I'm the white version, you know, or whatever. You know, you see yourself as the person who can survive till the end or who is going to fight back. Like, what would I do in that situation?
Did you have a favorite? Like I remember thinking Nancy was probably the one the first one I could identify with as a young guy because of her intellect. And I mean, rather than just being a character who's running, she was somebody outthinking.
Trying to outthink Freddy, make traps,
exactly.
And really
so I could
outsmart
fully,
her villain.
Yeah, I could fully get on board with her as the main character, not just the final girl. You're the lead.
Sure, of course.
Was there anyone like that for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit younger, so I mean,
says you.
I mean, right, little. Scream was a movie that I saw in the theater, and I was a teenager still. So
okay, she is younger. All right.
Now, Elric, that came out our first year of college.
Yeah, but we weren't teenagers.
I remember going. I don't even know if I could drive. Yeah, like I feel like I went with a girlfriend and we loved it because she what is her name? Sydney.
Yeah.
Is you know, intelligent, and she kind of like outsmarts everybody, and she, and also it does have this sort of like sociological aspect to it where they're, you know, looking at all the tropes of movies in the past, which is a place where I grew up because all these movies had already been established. We already knew everything about the horror movie tropes. We weren't discovering them. We were like playing with them at that point.
Yeah. Did you have
them? Alien. I love Ripley. Yeah. I've always loved Ripley.
Yeah,
she was like, because it was never addressed. It's kind of like my theory of women in horror. Like, I don't get up on a soapbox and yell at people. I just try to, you know, move through, be a good leader. And that is exactly was like Ripley's theory is, you know, it was never like she's a woman in charge. It was never drawn attention to.
Was she written as a man?
Right, she was written as a man.
Yeah. And then she was kind of part of it.
And that's, I think, you know, she was written as a human in that regard.
And then Cameron took it up a notch when he did the scene. He was like, well, let's really put me in.
There's an essay out there, the Monstrous Feminine, Barbara Creed, and it is such a good read about Alien and about all the female sexual symbolism throughout the movie and all the caves and all the mother. It's all about mothers and this character is kind of going against motherness. Mm-hmm. And it's a good essay.
I think a copious amount of that was Geiger's work with the production design because everything Geiger is about giving birth and spines and fetuses.
Right.
And
one Descent has it too. Remember we talked to Neil Marshall about how the Descent has all these things and he had no idea. Like it's in the extra feature and he's walking along and he's designed literally a vaginal cave and one of the girls, because it's all girls in the cast, and they're like, oh, so that we all descended to the vaginal cave. He goes, oh, I had never noticed it was designed that way. And it was just like, he had no idea, which I love.
Well, we had some questions and stuff from the group. Do we want to tackle some of these before we wrap up?
We can. We have been asked in one of these, you know, where do we think it's all going to go, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've been seeing this on social media as well. You know, it's like, where do you think horror is going to go? Oh, horror is going to get a little bit more extreme and highly political now that we're under the Trump administration. It's like, I say this time and time again, let it happen organically.
Yes.
Do not force the issue. If you have that anger or that sadness or something to say or that frustration, channel it through an idea mm-hmm. that is, you know, relatable or whatever, and let that stuff simmer in the background, but do not force it, because once you start forcing it, you're going to have bad horror.
Yeah. You know? What do you mean? Like, you mean like make like, a movie just specifically about
Bria,
Trump?
I want to make a horror movie about how much I hate Trump or or how much I'm pro Trump, you mm-hmm. know, and I hate all these, you know, and it's like, I'm going to go set out and force pen to paper to come up with something that you
specifically
know,
has specifically that agenda.
Has that stuff mm-hmm. yeah. that never works. That's like yeah. going out and saying, I'm going to create the next Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, also one reason why it doesn't work is it can take a couple years for your movie to get made. By then, things might have switched.
Yes.
Yeah, might have been,
oh, yes, totally yeah, true. Yeah.
It could be it, talking about by the, then,
anything the realism of it all. But I mean, and, you know, thematically speaking, it's just like let whatever story you want come through. Let the force flow through you. You know, yeah. It's just like let it just happen organically. If you have, you know, if there's some sort of frustration, get out. You know, get out. We made. Literally, I was getting my time hop thing, and it was like a picture of Jason on the set a year ago today.
Oh,
like,
wow.
We made
that's
it
quick.
A year
oh, wow.
ago this week yeah. we yeah. were making
and
it.
And that's actually really but quick it was, for a movie.
But the point being is it happened before all of this nonsense.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Well, because it's been – yeah, that racism's coming from way back. I don't view it as Trump, right? That kind of racism. I think it – yeah. It's
but I think that that's –
roots racism.
To answer that question, I think that is a direction that Hollywood and horror films are going, is that – we're having a lot of Hollywood is having like a big fucking wake up call when it comes to race and, mm-hmm. and even like women's roles yeah, in, yes. within movies. And we're suddenly like paying attention. I don't know why now. I mean, I think because so many people have brought attention to it.
You social
know,
media, big part.
Social
of it.
Media. I mean, mm-hmm. you see Oscar so white. You see like, and I think it's great because movies are moving in that direction where we're paying attention. We're making more stories about not just like a white protagonist.
Yeah.
It's one way that movies will survive and stories will survive. People always say death of cinema. It won't happen because as long as we keep diversifying it, we won't run out of new things and new perspectives.
Well, there's so many stories that haven't
it's
been
impossible.
Told.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. You have a lot of people who've been telling the same story over and over again.
But if the same group of people kept telling the same story, I do think it'd be the death of that art form. Mm-hmm. It is really just about turning it by a degree, and it's a whole new thing. Yeah.
And the one thing we realize is Get Out is number one this weekend, yeah. Yeah. right? Yeah. Then, I mean, is it sells. Like, people go see it. People actually are really interested in the diversification of storytelling.
And it's not yeah. because he's black, it's because he made a damn good movie. And
that's the thing.
That's the problem with the Oscars. So yes. white, my biggest concern was that the following year, they'd find just some really crappy movie, and just because it was made by a black person, they'd give that the Oscar. Instead, the best movie of the year, in my opinion, won the Oscar. And, like, the movie I liked most, Moonlight, I was like, mm-hmm. and then it won the Oscar. I was like, holy crap.
Yeah.
It all somehow worked out in a beautiful storyline. But it could. You don't want things to just swing for the sake of swinging. You want it to be, because he was saying, because it's organically good work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
so our standards
I'm encouraged by that idea of, I think it was Michael Gingold who wrote a piece, was it maybe for Rue Morgue's website, about how, you know, things like Don't Breathe and Split and now Get Out are, you know, these original ideas that are different and haven't been done before are overperforming over things like Rings or, you know, like something that's already been done. So,
and Rings had its time. Rings found its moment. It had its time. And, you know, and Gingold's article absolutely, you know, speaks to horror is on the move. Horror has to change. Horror has to evolve, you know. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, like and so, you know, where are we going to go with all of it? Who knows? Maybe somebody will come up with the next They Live scenario in a very political, cool, fun way, you know. But again, like, just don't force the issue. Just let it come out.
You never see waves coming.
It's all about feeling,
right?
Yeah.
You never see good waves.
You don't, but for those of us like working on this side of things, I think we read them in waves. Right. Like, I will read so many movies that are like, wow, they're making this many cult movies.
Yeah. Or like, you know, like just a big cult boom.
A couple years ago, it was like several cult TV shows and just like all the, Babysitters. Yeah. There's like, I mean, it's just like you'll see this stuff come in waves, and there's something within the cultural zeitgeist that's driving this, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, something is making us all go cult. You know, we've read about it in the news. We all feel like we're being drawn to cults. I don't know, but something about it, and I think we'll look back and be able to recognize that a lot more clearly.
Have you ever, as an actress, have you ever had to like turn down something because of that side of it? Not so much taste, like, I don't think this is a good script, but the actual politicized or the way they treat a woman in a film, have you looked at
absolutely
the same? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because I do a lot of genre stuff, but it's not necessarily genre stuff. I turned down a movie that was a dark comedy because it had a rape scenario in it that I didn't feel like it needed. And for me, that's a place where I draw a line. A lot of other stuff doesn't bother me, but that, like, to have like a non-needed rape scene in a movie that's really graphic, I just didn't feel like it was needed. That was a comedy. It was like a
in that kind of situation, do you try to have a conversation to see if you can change their end, the creative end, or you just not get involved?
I'm not that important of an actress. Okay. No one cares.
You are in this room.
No, I don't usually. Because by the time usually I get to that's not necessarily true. I mean, I guess I have gone through and been like, hey, just so you know, from a female perspective, right. You could do – I definitely will give people that.
Well, because you also have a lot of friends who are writers. So with those friends, you have that perspective.
And you know, and they send me scripts quite a bit. And I'll give them and I'll get attached to a movie early on, and then I will give them, you know, sort of like feedback, especially about my character. You know, I try not to do too much like tackling of the story because at the point after I've been attached as an actress.
Yeah. Any other good like shorter ones we could do that are?
Well,
less...
I'm looking. You pulled all the political ones.
Oh, and so. We kind of covered them all.
Yeah.
Well, because there's all kind
you
of. One
you
thing.
Pulled all the political ones. You know, someone Frank Barnett. I actually kind of like this one. Maybe discuss how us horror fans seem desensitized to most horror out there nowadays, but the real stuff still gets us pretty acutely. I could cheer on a protruding eyeball being cut off on the screen, but seeing a bone break in real life will have me lose my lunch. It's an interesting question because it was a prophecy that I never thought would come true at one time. Is someone told me that like I would become desensitized to horror and not be affected by stuff, and they were absolutely right because as I get older, I'm like, oh yeah, that's you know, it's all fantasy to me. It's all you know. I think when you're a kid. Everything is new. You love that like kind of tangibility of effects and all that other stuff. And somebody was like, you're going to get tired of them. I'm like, I'm not going to get tired of horror, but I guess the way I get shocked and I can go to Live Leak right now and I can pull up five videos that I will absolutely lose my shit over.
I do not know what that is.
Live I don't want to know what it is.
It's like a video site.
it's a video aggregator site that pulls like – this man got his hand chopped off during an initiation video, and it's an actual thing.
You don't want to see it.
Or watch these people blow up because a tanker truck exploded.
So you can watch that?
Here's the thing. I dip into that when I need to get grounded real fast. Like, I go, oh, what's the worst fucking thing I could see today? Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Wow, that is terrible. Then I'll shut down for a minute. Get regrounded.
We're running so low on this, by the way. We're all going like, no, thank you.
No, I know. Nobody else. No, but
he is Frank from Hellraiser, as you said before.
I get curious. I get curious every once in a while. I'm like, oh, what's the worst thing I could watch today? Yeah, that is definitely
I can't. Wow. I can't watch any of that stuff.
No, I mean, we've talked about it before. Though. I think it's this exact same thing as why us horror, the ones who really got into it as kids, were also the biggest scaredy cats. It was the same thing. It was to become owners of our fears in a fantasy realm where we were safe. And I'm like that. I don't want to see blood. I don't want to see real surgeries or real operations. And yet in films can watch anything.
Yeah.
So I think there is some weird – there's a funny duality about it. But it's. I definitely think it's there for most of us.
I wrote an article on the site about this comparing myself to a fainting goat because I pass out at the sight of my own
That's
blood.
That's how I view you.
Is it? Yeah, it's totally. No, I do. Like,
someone
seriously.
Make a gif of Becca.
As the fainting goat.
As a fainting goat. Becca fainting
I actually
goat.
Put a gif of it in the article where I was like, I faint. Here it is. This is me. But honestly, it is how I, in my own brain, have proven that you do not make like real life connections with the stuff that you watch on screen. Because if I right now, one of the worst things that ever happened to me, I was in high school, I was changing a light bulb in my room and it was still hot and it shattered in my hand. Ew. And I ended up having to get like 8 stitches. But I remember just looking down at my hand and then I hit the floor and my mom woke me up like 20 minutes later in the car on the way to the hospital. And she was like, you need stitches. But that type of thing still happens. I mean, I can get like paper cuts or, you know, small things, but anything that's like major, I'm out cold.
Yeah.
But I have never once had that feeling in a horror film. So it's like your brain realizes that there is a difference between reality and the film.
I might have been a fainting goat. Might have been a fainting goat watching We Are the Flesh.
Nope. See, that one, I mean, I was
I would
like,
oh.
I was shocked. And I kept,
yes.
I spent the whole time going, is that a real penis? Is that a real penis?
No more.
Elric, what's the deal? Why haven't you seen this yet?
Because when somebody sent me the link, it didn't have English subtitles. So I watched the first 10 minutes and there weren't words. And then suddenly they started talking.
Sometimes images
transcend.
No, and trust me.
I will get to
them
it.
Being a penis in it is in no way a spoiler.
There are things that I don't scare that don't scare me in horror movies, like the blood stuff that doesn't scare me, but other stuff still does, and it's the same shit that scares me in my real life, like people breaking into my house, cannot watch a home invasion movie.
That's my biggest like I can't.
Yeah, it's so scary. I just can't handle.
It makes you hyper aware. It makes you hyper aware of your surroundings.
Oh,
it makes
you hyper aware of everything. Trust me. That's I would like, definitely like MacGyver the house and like, you know, or I don't know, Home Alone the house, whatever you would do. Like someone was trying to break it.
And see, I do still get scared in movies. Like jump scares still work on me fine. Mm-hmm. I still leave horror movies going, oh my God, that was freaky. And I think that as soon as that stops, I'll like, I'm going to have to find a new job because then it's like my roller coaster ride. It's no longer there.
Yeah, we have to keep some of that alive.
You know what? A movie actually really scared me recently was the Slender Man documentary. I couldn't sleep that night because I was like, well, what if this crazy teenage girl breaks into my house and tries to murder me? Which is not a real fear. It shouldn't be a fear.
No. You know what I'm really scared is what if they're telling the truth? What if Slender Man was really talking
about it? See, that's less scary than crazy teenage girls to me.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
I would say, you know, in terms of like tackling any further questions, I mean, like I'm looking at the thread and predominantly it's all about the topic that we covered today.
Yeah.
So I think we did our homework, guys.
Well done, guys.
We did.
We did it.
And we're going to open this up like once a month. That's a cool idea.
I think it'd be fun. I would love to wrap up by saying that humbly, please vote for us.
We're nominated for Rondo Awards.
And let me just be clear about one thing. Don't do it for me. Don't do it for Rob. Don't do it for Becca. Do it for Ryan, who does not have a Rondo Award.
Ryan doesn't have a Rondo Award.
We already have one.
As winners of Rondo's Award, like having one is really different than not having one.
Oh.
And, you know, especially if you ran a website for that many years.
Yeah.
He was a great. Hey, I loved Shock in his era.
Shock and Jump got nominated this year.
So even if you hate our show.
And the funny thing is, it doesn't even exist.
I know.
Even if you don't like our show now, vote for him because of how good a job he used to do on Shock. But we do appreciate it because it's very easy to not do that. Yeah. And you'll think that your fellow friends and cohorts on the group are doing it, so you don't have to. That's not how voting works. Yeah. But we will only win if you all vote for us, and that would be nice. Especially because some of them other sons of bitches are nominated. We want to just take them down.
Podcast wars.
Well, don't forget to join us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Yes, and Bria, where can we find you on those things?
Just Bria Grant is my social media handle and everything. At Bria Grant on Twitter and Instagram.
There you go.
And to close up, hey, Texans, get excited because we're pretty much locked.
I got plane tickets to Texas
Frightmare.
Oh, that's so cool.
We'll be there. We will be hosting some fun stuff, and we're going to make it fun.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
All right.
Give me all the barbecue,
Let's
guys.
Party.
Thanks, Bria. That was fun.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.